You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
And the one that always really still bothers me was David O'Brien, who was the chief science in charge of monitoring nuclear activity around the globe at Patrick Air Force Base. So he's supposed to be sitting at his U.S. Air Force computer, seeing if there's any kind of nuclear activity that might threaten our security as Americans. And what is he doing? Instead, he's on his U.S. Air Force computer on child pornography websites and chats trading in child pornography.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Lori Handrahan. Today's show, America's Traffic in Child Pornography. Lori Handrahan completed her PhD at the London School of Economics and later taught at American University in Washington, D.C. She worked as an independent consultant to the United Nations on gender equality. She is the author of Epidemic, America's Trade in Child Rape. Epidemic is a meticulously researched and documented account of rampant child pornography, abuse, and rape that has reached global dimensions. Today we discuss her research into the sadistic nature of pedophilia, the lack of data collection on a fast-growing crime wave, child rape as a profit model, the proliferation of servers, websites, pictures, and videos, online networks, child porn on government agency computers, and the powerful as perpetrators. Dr. Lori Handrahan, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on the show.
You were a professor at American University in Washington, D.C., and your career was targeted. You lost your teaching position there and have been unable to secure another position. What were you teaching at American University, and what was the reason given for you losing your job?
Yeah, well, it's a very, thank you for asking the question. It's a very painful subject. I was in the International Development Department in the School of International Service, and American University is still a very special place for me, and it had been my professional home since I was 30. So I would teach, I'd take a term contract, teach for a year, and then I'd go back to the field and usually work for the United Nations because I do applied social science, and my background has all been in sexual gender-based violence in war zones, humanitarian response. So I had been on and off at American University over a long period of time, had always received very, very good student evaluations and done very good work. And I felt like the faculty were my family. It was my home. The official reason that I was wrongly terminated was that I couldn't keep my personal life off campus. And I was being, by the definition of Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police, felony stalked. So I was felony stalked on campus for a year and a half. And by that, I mean my students were emailed on a regular basis. My colleagues, professors, my supervisors, the president of the university, the dean, the lawyers at the university, they were all emailed on a regular basis. Week in, week out, over a 1.5 year period. The Facebook page for the School of International Service was constantly under attack. And it was really, really awful. What AU asked me to do was not to report the crime of stalking, because it would make the university look bad, they felt, and that as long as I continued to perform at outstanding professional levels, they promised me I wouldn't lose my job. So they made me endure and cover up a crime and be a victim of that crime on campus for a year and a half. And then they terminated me because I couldn't stop that crime.
Well, why were you being stalked? Why were you and your colleagues and your students being stalked?
I was being stalked by my ex-husband and his attorney. And I was being stalked because my 2-year-old daughter was raped by her father at the age of 2. And she was confirmed for that rape by the sexual assault medical examiners. Unanimous, the entire team had a unanimous decision on that. And then she was put into his sole custody in a very corrupt family courtroom in Maine, Judge Jeff Moskowitz. Family courts have become a secure supply line for pedophiles to obtain control and access to their children. That's pretty well known now. And I refuse to be silent. The sad thing is, and with a lot of the headlines now about Larry Nassar and Weinstein and the Me Too movement, there's a much more frame of reference for me to explain what's happened to my life and my daughter's life. If I had been silent about her rape at the age of two by her father, I would still have my career. I'd still be a professor. I'd still have my homes. I'd still have my friends. I'd still have an income, employment, retirement. So some of the victims from Larry Nassar talked about the price that they paid by going public about his abuse. And, you know, one woman said she lost her friends, she lost her church. And, you know, that's what's happened to me as well, only much more severely.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Handrahan. I didn't even realize where I was going with that question. That's horrifying.
Thank you. Well, I mean, thank you for being sympathetic. This is why I've written the book. So the book is not about my daughter's case and my case personally, but it's dedicated to her. And as a social scientist, as they started stripping everything away from me, what I did was, what the only thing I could do was I put my PhD research degree to use, and I started researching. I thought, if this is happening to me and my daughter, it must be happening to many, many other children and mothers in America. So when I was at American University and they had taken my daughter, I started doing research and publishing on this subject in Forbes magazine and Canadian television interviews and Washington Times and The Hill. And also American University president's office had asked me not to publish and write on this and had ordered American University's media department not to pitch me to journalists. So I may have also been wrongly terminated for that. I'm not sure. I am speculating. But so that was the beginning. I've been doing this research now for about 8 years, and the book is sort of a accumulation of that work, where as a social scientist, I took lots of data and put it together and said, is there a pattern here? And there is very much a pattern of epidemic child rape across America, largely by white men in positions of power.
In your new book, Epidemic, America's Trade in Child Rape, I was glad to see that you did not treat pedophilia as a sexual orientation. Rather, you write, quote, what is being done to our children is not child pornography, exploitation, or sex. It is rape and torture, often meeting the Convention Against Torture definition. Some believe the term pedophilia should be pedosadism, because what is being done to children is not, quote, child love, as pedophilia implies, but sadistic, violent abuse, sadism. You go on to say that pedophiles ask for pictures of babies being raped. In one instance, quote, the bloodier, the better. How widespread is this sadism?
Yeah, I thank you very much for citing that quote. I'm really grateful that you've picked up on that, Bonnie. I think this is what was also a challenge in writing the book, was to be able to get people to understand how this crime operates without showing so much horror that people turn away. And so I tried not to sensationalize the crime or get into too much that people couldn't handle. The violence is the dominant part of the crime. So I've read hundreds and hundreds of criminal complaints. And what is happening is that if a man is arrested in your town for child pornography, and you read the local media report or you hear about it on a radio show or TV show, the journalists will often say, he was arrested on 3 counts of child pornography and he was found with 30,000 images of child pornography. And that means nothing. It didn't mean anything to me until I started doing the research. What does that mean, 30,000 images of child pornography? Well, when you then get the criminal complaint, which is what I've done in my research, I would contact the law enforcement, contact the prosecutor's office, contact the courts, and get the criminal complaint. And it depends, of course, on who wrote the criminal complaint. Some of them are excellent. Some of them aren't very good. But the really good criminal complaints go into extreme detail about what the man, usually it's men, were doing. And so they'll even include in the criminal complaints the chats that the pedophiles are having online. And one you cited where the man was saying the bloodier the better. So what's deeply concerning is that they're brutally raping and torturing the children. So my understanding from reading hundreds of criminal complaints is that the rape happens after they've committed the violence of the children, that they get sexually stimulated by committing these acts of brutal violence against the children. Another one that I had used in the book because I felt that it reached people was a former professor at the University of Toronto who had been a deputy minister of education in Canada. So very elite, very respected in the community. And he was chatting with a mother who was offering her children for rape, who was in reality an undercover cop. And he had said something along the lines of, it really turned him on to see that his lover would harm her children to give him pleasure. And so he was grooming the mother and instructing the mother on how to beat her children and harm her children. And in one picture, there was a child with black mascara and eyeliner streaming down her face crying. And he said that he thought this was very hot, that it turned him on to see the child crying in pain. So I do try to make that very clear in the book, and I'm glad you've picked up on that.
You mean the violent aspect to all of this?
Yes. Yeah.
You write that, quote, pedophiles also discuss and are involved in killing children with what seems to be alarming frequency. In 2000, right. for example, The Guardian reported, you wrote about this, on a British child snuff network, which included a video series entitled Necros Pedo, where children were raped and tortured until they died. Many of the children had been taken from Russian orphanages, end quote. And, you know, I did read that Putin signed a bill in December of 2012 that bans the adoption of Russian children by American citizens.
Yes. So that was very common. So what I try to explain, especially when I give talks on the book too, is that if you think like a pedophile, you will think, how do I establish a secure supply line to children? So you're not just molesting or raping one child, you know, like Larry Nassar, who's dominating headlines right now. Everybody was shocked that something like 150 women came forward. That's what pedophiles do. If they're allowed to do that, they will rape hundreds of children over the course of their lifetime. And what they do is they establish secure supply lines where they can continually gain access to one vulnerable child after another. So you think like a pedophile, and adoptions is a secure supply line. So it's very well known, if you talk to lawyers who represent child sex abuse victims, they will tell you that the entire adoption industry is rife with pedophiles. There have been a number of arrests of men who have adopted children from Russia, who specifically adopted the children with the intent of using them as sex slaves and producing child pornography. Of that, those rapes and torture. Another secure supply line is disabled children. So when you look at how many special education teachers are being arrested on this crime, it makes sense, because a disabled child, like a Down syndrome child, can't be a witness in court. So pedophiles will specifically build careers as special education teachers so that they can have constant access to severely disabled children to rape. If you start to look at doctors, which I didn't profile in the book, I focused on mainly on government employees, but if it's up on my Medium site, if you look at doctors, you'll notice not only pediatricians, of course, being arrested for child pornography in large numbers, but pediatric oncologists. So again, if you think like a pedophile, a dead child can't be a witness. So if you become a pediatric oncologist, you're in a position like Larry Nassar, where you can elevate yourself, you're in a privileged position of power over vulnerable children, and you can abuse them, and they're going to die before they can be a witness against you. So this is how pedophiles think. It's about securing supply lines to many, many, many children over decades.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Lori Handrahan. Today's show,
America's Traffic in Child Pornography. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
And, of course, you've referenced Larry Nassar. Now, he was that Olympic coach, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was a professor at Michigan State University and a coach for the Olympic, the gymnast team. So I had been tracking that case since last year because he's up on my professor and staff list on Medium of how many professors and staff are being arrested around the country. And it's a perfect case, actually, and I think it's captured America's attention because most people don't realize how these cases go. So he was originally charged on federal child pornography, and he was doing preteen hardcore PTHC, which is the brutal, violent torture of very young children. And so his criminal complaint, the local journalists did very good reporting, and they made public his federal criminal complaint. So you can see what he was trading in, the videos that he was trading in, and the names of the videos. I mean, you can't actually watch the videos, but you can see the titles in his criminal complaint. So very often, if somebody is arrested and prosecuted on federal child pornography charges, that'll be the end of the case. Nobody will look and search to see if there was also hands-on child abuse. Sometimes the state won't bring charges. So, but in Larry Nassar's case, the state brought charges as well, which is what we've just seen this last trial of this past week. And they also went public, thanks to the Indy Star, who did great reporting, you know, asking more victims to come forward. And then we had this amazing judge who allowed every single person to stand up and do a victim impact statement. So with Larry Nassar's case, you can really see the whole scope of this. So many of the men who are being arrested on child pornography charges, they're never investigated and charged for hands-on abuse, but they're always abusing children. You can't trade in child pornography unless you're hands-on abusing a child. That's part of the nature of the crime.
You write that, quote, this crime is not about sexual attraction. You go on to note that mental health officials write about, quote, attraction to prepubescent youngsters. You enumerate three key flaws in the mental health argument about attraction with regard to pedophilia. What has your research revealed about the real motives behind pedophilia?
That's a great question, Bonnie. Thank you so much for asking me that. So I do have a chapter at the beginning of the book called The Crime, where I sort of describe what the crime is before we get into the crime. And I'm a social scientist. I'm not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. So people often ask me what you've just asked me, why? Why would these men do this? And I don't know. And I've really tried to focus on the legal mechanics and the impunity and the investigation mechanics, and also trying to detail the scope that it is an epidemic that's going on so that we could have a research agenda to create good public policies that will help stop the crime. That's really been my focus. So I really can't tell you what motivates these people. I speculate about it, and I have a chapter on that as well in the book. But in terms of the mental health profession, I've been, extremely disappointed by some, and I feel too many in the mental health profession, who seem to be pedophile protectors. And I do have a sentence in the book where I say, you know, you could do an entire book just on all the psychiatrists and psychologists who have been arrested for child pornography themselves. So if you become a child psychologist, you know, you're putting yourself in a position of power over vulnerable children. So it's another pipeline profession, particularly for white men, to access vulnerable children for sex abuse. So I don't know, but the three arguments that I had in the book about the sexual attraction, it has nothing to do with sexual attraction. That is very clear just from reading hundreds and hundreds of criminal complaints, is that what they talk about all the time is their desire to harm children. So I write in the book that some of the files that I've read that they trade in, torture 1-2, they write, slut hurt me on the bodies of very small children before they rape them. They want to see children bound and gagged, hurt and bleed, and sometimes murdered. So if there's any, quote, attraction to this crime, it's about white men in power being attracted to harm society's most vulnerable children. And then they talk about an automatic sexual preference for children. And that's not what's happening here. Pedophiles rape and abuse children because they can do it because we're not protecting our children. And again, to go back to the Larry Nassar example, just because it's so current in everybody's mind, this is what all of those women stood up and said, well, you know, what's the price of a child? What about us? Why didn't you protect us? And there was one young woman who was six when Nassar first started raping and molesting her, and her family didn't believe her. And her father, she thinks, committed suicide later because he realized that she was being sexually abused.
There is no comprehensive data collection on child pornography or arrests of pedophiles, according to your book. You say that America's fastest growing crime is one we know almost nothing about. How is it possible for child pornography to be categorized as the fastest growing crime, and there is little detailed data about this war against children? What about the lack of perpetrator data?
Yeah, that's such a great question, Bonnie. So this is really the whole point of my book. I can't establish the data and the research that I'd like to because I don't have an academic position. So good research is very expensive. I'd need a position back and graduate students and money to set up a database. But we need a national database so that we can give real statistics on what's happening. Nobody has the data. And this evolved out of when I would contact journalists and I'd say, hey, you just reported on this arrest. Could you actually show the criminal complaint? And do you know how many professors are being arrested? And could you provide some context instead of just one-off arrests on your daily crime beat? And they'd say, well, give me statistics, give me data. And I'd say, there is no data. Nobody has the statistics yet. So I had a chance to speak briefly to Senator Portman, who's been leading the fight on this, Senator from Ohio. And he said that he's also concerned about the data problem. So for example, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, I have that as an action item in the book. They haven't updated just the federal prosecutions for child pornography since 2012. So even if the U.S. Sentencing Commission were asked by senators and asked by the general public to provide comprehensive demographics on federal child pornography prosecutions, we would have a much better idea of what's going on. We absolutely need to have a national database available.
You write that, quote, the easy profit model of child rape is rapidly overtaking drugs and guns as organized crime's preferred moneymaker. Children are a renewable resource. They can be sold multiple times a day over many years and are easy to transport. Their rape can be sold online and in person. Their organs can be sold on the black market. End quote. This reminds me of a story in a Spanish language newspaper here in California that reported on a truck that was stopped and searched in Mexico. In the truck were dead bodies of children whose organs had been removed. I never saw that story reported here in English. According to your book, pedophilia is a crime wave that is generating a lot of money. How much and for whom?
Well, yeah, again, we can only speculate. And what I did was I put up some of the numbers that people have been talking about. Even if we had really good research and comprehensive data, because it's an illegal industry, we would never have perfect data. But we could have a lot better data than what we have. So, yeah, when you talk to law enforcement and prosecutors who are on the front lines of this war against our children in America, they will tell you that they are completely overwhelmed with these cases. And there's no way they can even begin to keep up, and that the pedophiles are far ahead of law enforcement and prosecutors. So they will speculate, people are speculating, that it has or is about to take over guns and drugs. And it makes a lot of sense because you're trying to sell guns or drugs. You have one, a logistics problem in transportation. Guns and drugs are difficult to transport. You have to hide them. They're heavy. They're costly to transport. A child's easy to transport. Most people don't even know that you're transporting that child for sex. You might just be a father who has custody of your child on the weekend, and you're taking that kid around the country for rape. That happens all the time. The men will travel, and they'll say, I have custody of my child. I'm willing to share. So nobody knows. It's not like you've got a trunk load full of guns and drugs. It's just a child in the back seat. The other thing is that you sell that a gun or a drug and that's it, but a child can be sold over and over and over again. So it's like I said, it's a child's a renewable resource. So if you are interested in that, it's a great criminal profit model. You sell the child in person for the in-person rape. They always document that rape with videos and photographs, and live streaming is now very, very popular. So you get two sales, the in-person abuse and then the videos and the live streaming and the photos of that abuse. And then what they will do is child pornography snuff is very profitable. And my understanding from reading the criminal complaints is that they will slowly torture the child over a period of time. And so they'll say, you know, tune in next week for the next video. And people will follow this like we would follow a soap opera, you know, who shot JR, tune in next week to find out. So, and then you pay more and more for the video. And then when the child's finally murdered on camera, that's the high paying video. And then they can sell the organs on the black market. So it's a great profit model.
What about websites and servers? Is there data on that? And has there been a dramatic increase in U.S.-based sites? What is the volume of pictures and videos of child rape being traded online?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So the Internet Watch Foundation is doing some of the very best work on this, and I detail that in the book. They're based out of the U.K., and you can go on their website and see. So this past year was the very first year that Holland overtook America. But until this year, America has been producing and distributing about half of the world's child pornography. And it's a guess, right? But half of the servers that are distributing child pornography, about half, are based here in America. And that's a known fact. That's in Europol police reports that are publicly reported. The UK press has reported on this. Not one American journalist has reported on this. So this is one of my points of extreme frustration. If we know that about half of the servers distributing child pornography are based in America, we know where they are at, we have their locations, that's public, how come they're not being shut down? How come the media isn't reporting on this? I mean, it's just staggering the amount of child pornography that's being produced right here in America with American children and distributed around the world.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Lori Handrahan. Today's show, America's Traffic in Child Pornography. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that pedophiles joining online networks must first prove they are pedophiles. How do they do this?
Right. So that's another thing that people don't often understand. So the very first thing that happens, as far as I understand, from all of my research, is that when a pedophile will try to join an online forum, a pedophile chat, a website, member-only website, the very first thing that will happen is that the members will say, well, we need to see your computer. You have to show us your files so that we know you're not a cop, right? So they all know that the cops, they go undercover on these chats, and they're all scared. They'll talk about, I need assurances that you're not a police officer, that you're not an undercover officer. And the way that you prove that you're not a police officer and you're really a real criminal is that you open up your computer to these file sharing software so that anyone, you know, can see what's actually on my computer, and you show your collection. And so by showing your collection, you prove that you're a real criminal, and then you gain access. So all of the sites and forums work differently. There's one that's now been shut down that was quite famous called Dreamboard, and it was really brutal, really horrific torture of very small children. And members would get points by providing the more brutal videos and images that the member would provide and the newer ones. So they always want new children. It's not enough to see the same rape of the same child. They want access. Do you have somebody new? I've already seen that rape. Give me a new child. So the members would gain points by contributing. And they had, it was like a buyer's club almost, meaning like you had to provide so many new videos and images every month in order to maintain your membership level, like at a gold level or a platinum level. So there's a huge, huge push within the internal online pedophile community to be constantly raping and torturing children and providing new videos and images of that rape and torture into these online forums.
You write that, quote, staff in child protection agencies globally appear to be key players in securing supply lines of children for pedophiles' rings. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, you got to think like a pedophile, right? So if you're a pedophile, how are you going to secure a supply line of children that you can abuse, vulnerable children, right? Another thing that I say to try to explain this to people is anywhere there are vulnerable children, pedophiles have set up shop. So people often think, oh, it's just that one-off abuse. Poor little Johnny got abused by the priest. And, you know, poor little Jennifer was abused by her swim coach. No, these men have cultivated positions and they put each other in positions of power and oversight to protect their crimes so that they can abuse these children. So they are in shop, whether it's a school teacher, a special education teacher, a pediatric oncologist, or a child protection officer. So what better job if you're a pedophile than being a child protection officer? You have constant access to vulnerable children, right, to abuse. So in terms of the child protection staff, one of the most horrific arrests was the acting director of cybersecurity at the Department of Health and Human Services, DHSS. It was Timothy DeFoggi, and he actually was sentenced to 25 years in federal prison. And that goes back, you had asked me earlier about the violence. So the quote was that what he was involved in was so depraved that it even shocked veteran investigators. DeFoggi expressed the interest in the violent rape and murder of children and planned with other pedophiles to rape and murder children. So he's the acting director here in Washington of cybersecurity for the entire Department of Health and Human Services nationwide. Now, what's concerning about the DeFoggi case is that as far as I can tell from what's been publicly available, they didn't investigate his entire ring of all the other people that he was trading with. He's head of cybersecurity for Health and Human Services. Chances are he's probably trading with other Health and Human Services employees and Child Protective Services. And were children being used that had been taken into Child Protective Services on these things? Nobody asked any of those questions in that arrest. Now, the other element to Child Protective Services is what is now becoming publicly known is that a lot of the people who work in anti-sex trafficking will say the foster care system is rife with pedophiles and that so many foster care children end up on the streets being trafficked. Yeah, so it's rife with pedophiles because they have gone into Health and Human Services as child protection officers, right? It's a secure supply line.
Most images and videos seized in child pornography arrests are never investigated. Why is this?
Yeah, because it's just so incredibly overwhelming. So I discussed that in the book too. Like, and I think I mentioned like Australia's database where they, I think at that time they had something like 6 million images. So here's what happens. There are very few cops on the ground who are child sexual exploitation investigators. We have so many cops on the so-called war on drugs. So you might have 200 police officers who are assigned to the drug unit, okay? And then you have two cops assigned to the child exploitation unit, which is insane because they just can't possibly keep up. So one arrest will get you huge amounts of data. I mean, these guys are prolific collectors, so they don't just have one or two videos and images of one or two children. The arrests almost always have 30, 40, 50, 100,000 images and videos, right, of many, many children. Nobody has the time to sit down and look at 100,000 images and then to try to find those children. They just don't. So usually what happens is they'll go to the guy, they'll have their forensic van, if they have a forensic van outside the house. They'll try to get him to confess immediately. And if he confesses immediately, then they'll do an on-site quick forensic exam of his computer where they'll get at least like three or four videos that they'll describe in the criminal complaint. You know, he had this video, this video, this video. This is all child pornography. And then they'll do deeper forensic analysis of his computer. So by the time he goes for a plea deal, they'll say, yeah, well, he had 30,000, right? So, and that's just what he'll have at the time of arrest. Very often they have huge collections that are hidden within their drywall, in their attics. They go to huge, elaborate measures to hide their collections and to protect their collections. They never want to part with these. And then they try to get them to plea. So they'll say, we're going to charge you with 10 counts of child pornography, but if you plea, we'll charge you with one count, we'll drop the others, you're going to do 5 years in jail. And that's how it goes. They never, rarely investigate, were their hands on abuse of other children. And I've had cops say to me that when they were in the Internet Crimes Against Children unit doing child pornography arrests, they were never doing actual hands-on arrests of, you know, investigations of hands-on abuse. And then the same thing, the cops who were investigating child sex abuse, they're never also pulling a warrant for child pornography. So this is one thing that really needs to change within law enforcement. Every time they do a child pornography arrest, they should also be putting out the word and asking people to come forward for hands-on sex abuse, and vice versa. If they're arresting a man for hands-on sex abuse, they got to pull a warrant for child pornography, because the two are synonymous. The problem is they just don't have the resources to do that right now. There aren't enough law enforcement investigating this crime.
In your book, you say that, quote, as early as 2009, the Department of Justice warned America that infants and toddlers were being raped in increasing numbers. Infant and toddler pornography is the rape and torture of children under 4 years old, is what you write. Who is trafficking in infants and toddlers, and how?
If you think like a pedophile, this is a strategic decision. So under fours can't be witnesses in court. So, and there's even a book from a really brilliant Canadian journalist whose work I reference in my book, where he spent a lot of time actually embedded in the child exploitation units of the police. So he had access firsthand to watch them do their investigations. And there was one father on a chat line who said, okay, you know, my daughter is starting to talk. So I'm going to start abusing the infant that we just had, me and my wife. And she's a little young, but I've got to start her now before she can talk. So a child who can't talk, a pre-verbal child who can't explain what's happening to them, is an ideal target for a pedophile, because they can't be prosecuted for that crime because there's no witness to that crime, right? So, and under fours, they aren't out on the street. They're not at hockey practice. You can't abuse them on the away game bus for soccer practice or, you know, in the church. It's parents and caregivers who are involved. So this is the other thing that there's not enough discussion about. I reference in the book, the Canadian Child Protection, about this time last year, came out with a very important piece of research that said it's now a well-known tragedy that fathers are the leading pedophiles for child pornography rings. Fathers with access to their children, and it's very small children. And you will also see this in the criminal complaint. The cops go on the networks and the cops will say, hey, I have my 8-year-old son for the weekend and I'm sharing him, right? And the cops say that because that's how they trade the children.
Oh my God, it's hard to believe we're even talking about this. Wow, what a deal.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But that, I'm glad that you say that, Bonnie, because that's what people just say, oh, no, I don't want to hear, this is horrible. How could you even write this book? I don't want to talk about this. And what I say is that's exactly what pedophiles count on. Pedophiles count on the good people who protect children, who love children, turning away because it's too difficult to talk about. It's too painful to confront. They're counting on your silence, you know, and we have to end that silence. We have to be willing to look at what's happening in our country and start protecting our children.
You write that the New York Times published an op-ed entitled, quote, Pedophilia, a Disorder, Not a Crime, by Margot Kaplan, a law professor at Rutgers, who argued child rapists are not criminals, but rather vulnerable disabled people who should receive civil rights protection under the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. You say that Kaplan's op-ed appears to be part of a well-organized strategy to create laws and norms that frame pedophiles and not our children as the victims. Did you notice any pushback in the paper against this op-ed?
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought that up. It's just appalling. I mean, appalling. She made that argument. It was jaw-dropping. There's not enough pushback because enough people aren't aware of what's happening in this country, that this has become an epidemic and how strategic the pedophiles are. So no, there should be a lot more pushback. And the media didn't report on this widely. You know, the media hasn't yet reported on it. I'm hoping now with Me Too, Harvey Weinstein, Larry Nassar, that we'll start to have some sustained and in-depth coverage and not just a 3-day news cycle so that Americans really understand what's happening. But yeah, I mean, if you start to look at local papers across the country, you'll see all of these pro-pedophile pieces popping up. The poor guy, he's the one we should feel sorry for. It's just a disorder. We should treat him with therapy. This is a violent criminal act.
You also point out that pedophiles in Greece have been given legal disability status.
It's amazing. It's just amazing. Just apart from an economic perspective, I mean, can you imagine giving every pedophile disability in America? I mean, if you look at how many are being arrested, you couldn't even afford to do that, number one. And number two, what about all these children who never even get therapy, whose lives are completely and absolutely destroyed by these criminals? No, it makes absolutely no sense to me. These are not disabled people. This is not a disorder. It's not about sexual attraction. Therapy can't cure it. These are violent criminals who deserve to be behind bars. They need to be lifetime sex offender registries, and they need to be on probation for their lifetime, because they almost always recommit after they get out of jail, almost always. You know, and chemical castration is a very interesting option that should be looked at more closely.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Lori Handrahan. Today's show, America's Traffic in Child Pornography. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You write that in May 2016, the Pentagon's Defense Security Service Director, Daniel Payne, told reporters the, quote, amount of child porn on government computers is just unbelievable. Which government agencies was he referring to?
Yeah, so I contacted his press person and I talked to them, and they sent me an email back and they said he was referring not to one agency in particular, but government computers as a whole across all government agencies. And again, so that got almost no media attention. The Christian Science Monitor did one really good in-depth story on that. And a few, I think the Daily Beast and a few others covered it. His quote when it happened. And then that's it. It just died. Most people don't even know that he made that statement. In fact, I've just written an op-ed that I haven't been able to get published. I've sent around to the Washington Post and the New York Times and everybody, called The Unbelievable National Security Problem, because just 2 weeks ago, two more government agents were arrested. One was Richard Gatowski, who was with ICE, and the other was Paul Whipple, who was a Border Patrol agent, right? They were both members of a child sex trafficking website that provided access to more than 117,000 graphic videos of child rape and torture. Gatowski used his government ID to open his account. He's using his government ID to open an account on a child sex trafficking website with 117,000 graphic videos of child rape. So, you know, it didn't even make news. Nobody even knows that happened. It made the local press where they were arrested, and that's it. It just dies down. So I can't get anybody to focus on this. I don't know how you have the Pentagon's Defense Security Service Director saying that the amount of child pornography on government computers is unbelievable, and that isn't headline news.
Strange that government agencies would allow access to pornography on their own computers. And how is how can that be? And how is this a national security issue?
Right. Well, it's a national security issue for several reasons. One, child pornography is run and maintained by organized crime. You are putting your government computer networks open to organized crime. Some of the child pornography is traded and produced and goes all over the world, right? So you never know who's in your network. If they're organized criminals or Turkish or anybody who wants to harm America, you've just opened your computer to all of that. Number two, you've made yourself available for blackmail, of course. And then number three, the amount of really high-level people in the government who are doing this really harms good government employees and good citizens who are simply trying to do their job. Another example I use is Army prosecutor and judge advocate Daniel Wolverton. He was sentenced for infant sodomy here in Virginia. So he was handcuffing a one-year-old, I believe it was a boy, if my memory is correct, and anally raping a one-year-old boy. I mean, can you imagine the horrific pain that that poor child was going through? He had 30,000 child rape images. So I ask, you know, would he have held his colleagues accountable for adult sexual abuse in the military workplace? an army prosecutor who was anally raping a one-year-old boy? No, he's not going to. If an adult woman is raped in the workplace and he's the judge and the prosecutor, he's going to protect the pedophile. So that links into the sexual assault in the military, which there's been widespread discussion about at the adult level. And that harms all of us, right? That harms our sense of national security, harms our ability to function as a productive civil society and democracy. The other thing about why it's such an incredibly important national security issue is that individual pedophiles, it's not an individual arrest. It's a highly networked crime. So this is another thing that's commonly misunderstood. A criminal committing any other kind of crime would do it alone or with one or two other people, would try to hide the crime, right? Pedophiles do not hide their crime. They brag about their crime. They commit these horrific crimes. They video themselves doing it, and then they broadcast these videos everywhere, bragging about what they've done to these children, right? And they network as a team. It's one of the defining behaviors of child pornography and pedophilia is their obsessive networking. And they not only network online, they network in person because they meet to share the children, right? So they know each other and they protect each other. And that's a very big problem for the security of our country when you have top military people. I have so many. If you go on my Medium site, I have a long list of military arrests. One was Colonel Robert Joel Rice. He was a colonel at the Army War College. He was charged with 130 child pornography counts, and he had more than 30,000 images of child sexual abuse. I mean, he's a colonel at the Army War College, a very senior man. There have been two former Navy assistant secretaries of state, and the one that always really still bothers me was David O'Brien, who was the chief science in charge of monitoring nuclear activity around the globe at Patrick Air Force Base. So he's supposed to be sitting at his U.S. Air Force computer, seeing if there's any kind of nuclear activity that might threaten our security as Americans. And what is he doing? Instead, he's on his U.S. Air Force computer on child pornography websites and chats trading in child pornography, right? He even used Russian sources material. He took images of his own granddaughter's head and he transposed those over images of children being brutally raped and tortured. And he did the same with adult females at the Air Force who were his colleagues. This is the guy who's supposed to be monitoring nuclear activity. And he's masturbating to the rape and torture of children from Russian sources on his Air Force computer. How is that not a serious national security issue?
What about those people in positions of power? How representative of the pedophilia epidemic are powerful people?
I think, you know, overwhelmingly it's men in leadership positions. They cultivate those leader positions, though, to commit the crime. So whenever I'm like reading a new arrest, now it's always the same pattern. So it's always the most decorated police officer who was officer of the year. And then he also volunteered with the Boys and Girls Club. And he gave so many hours that he became a Point of Light awardee. And they seek out awards and recognitions and cultivate positions of power to commit the crime. So it goes hand in hand. They're almost all white. So 80 to 90% of the federal child pornography prosecutions have been of white men. So that's a very significant element of it and a significant perpetrator profile. AP did a fabulous year-long investigation into child sexual assault in the military, and AP came up with the same results that I've come up with just in my own research, that overwhelmingly in the military, it was men in positions of power. So it wasn't the entry-level private. It was the colonel, the sergeant, the lieutenant colonel, the top guys. Same with the police. If you go onto my Medium site over and over and over again, it wasn't the entry-level police officer, it was the police chief. I mean, I had so many police chiefs that I had to create a separate section just for police chiefs.
What if those in powerful positions rose to the top because of and not in spite of the participation in child rape? Do you think this is a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. But I don't know the in spite of or because of, but certainly they network and they protect each other. So they put each other in positions of power. They recommend each other for promotions to positions of power. So any kind of oversight and accountability is completely removed. So, for instance, if you're the ombudsman in a state, like in Maine, the ombudsman for Child Protective Services was supposed to be the person that you went to if Child Protective Services wasn't doing their job. Well, in my opinion, what was going on was that the ombudsman was actually protecting the child protective workers who weren't doing their job. So they specifically make sure that they cannot be held accountable, and they help each other rise to these levels of power. Absolutely.
What about the legal profession and educators? You have chapters on these professions.
Yes. Horrific. So the number one amount of government employees in America are educators because of all of our public school teachers. So there's a quote from a really good researcher on educator predators where she says that she thinks that the abuse of children by educators is far more prolific than anything in the Catholic Church. And I would have to agree with her. I've been mainly focused on higher education, but there's just prolific abuse in daycares, kindergartens, primary schools, and secondary schools. USA Today did an outstanding year-long investigation on primary and secondary school educators who are predators, and it's just really overwhelming. For some reason, none of the higher education reporters and outlets, including the Chronicle of Higher Education, they have all refused to cover how many professors are involved in this. But really bad, just horrific. Back to just one point about the networking and the accountability. When I looked at professors who have been arrested, it's professors and staff who have been arrested at universities and colleges. What I started to notice in the staff arrests is that the IT staff kept coming up over and over and over again, which makes sense. So if you're a professor on a campus and you want to be able to masturbate in your campus office to child pornography, you're going to make sure that the IT people at your campus are also doing the same thing so that they won't report you to law enforcement, right? So it's a closed system of protection. That's very common. Then I have a chapter on lawyers. I think the legal profession bothers me probably the most because they have so much power. The prosecutors and the judges have so much power, and the wrongdoing by so many prosecutors and judges is just overwhelmingly horrific to me. I mean, there was one, I profiled one judge. He had a penis pump and he was masturbating on the stand as a judge during a murder trial. And there was another judge who actually got caught trafficking children. I'm always amazed actually when any of these judges get caught and go to jail. But thankfully, there are some incredibly supportive and strong law enforcement and prosecutors with integrity who will prosecute even judges and other prosecutors.
It sounds like the country is going off the rails. In reading your book, I immediately thought about the foreign wars, the 9/11 wars, specifically in the Middle East, Abu Ghraib, the black sites, the promotion of torture, the use of sexual humiliation and torture on Arab prisoners, all of it. Perhaps under these circumstances, we really shouldn't be all that surprised that pedo-sadism is rampant.
Yeah, I think that there are some links. You know, that's a very good point. One of the things that shocked me when I started to do this research was I would see over and over again that the man had been arrested for child pornography, including bestiality. So I started to dig into that. And so what's happening is that dogs are being trained to rape children. And I was like, who knows how to train dog? How do you even train a dog to rape a child? That's like an insane thing. And who would know how to do that? So I started researching. And of course, there have been allegations and very credible witnesses coming forward saying that the U.S. military had trained dogs to rape the Afghan prisoners, detainees, as part of a torture technique. So those dogs then come back to America. And then I have this also up on my site. There's some concern about where these dogs are going and how they're being rehomed. You know, they're coming back into our population. So I think that there are links there that certainly need to be researched and explored.
You devote your last chapter to the way forward. What are some of the ways forward to deal with this crisis?
Well, it's a great question, Bonnie. Thank you for asking that. So what I also tried to do in the book, because it is so horrific and you just want to turn away and you want to say this can't be possible, What I wanted to do was give people tools to actually make a difference and to change things. So I do have action items throughout the book that anybody can do. One thing we need is improved investigations and prosecutions. And that means we need far more money to hire far more prosecutors and law enforcement to cover the crime. We need thousands and thousands of law enforcement who are working the crime. And right now we don't have that at all. We need better media coverage of the epidemic. So we need journalists not just to say, so-and-so was arrested today on 3 counts of child pornography. We need the criminal complaint made public in the media reports, and we need the journalists giving context. So saying, and this was the 20th professor who's been arrested at this university, you know, in the past 6 years. They don't even go back to last year. I mean, I'm looking at universities where there's been arrest after arrest, but every single media report will report on the new arrest as if it was the first arrest at that institution. And then people need to say, all right, you've had an arrest at your institution, so what have you done to prevent this from happening in the future? That's the unmasking and the documenting that I say we need to show people what's really going on here, and we refuse to be silent. So anybody can call their local courthouse and they can say, I'd like to see the criminal complaint of this man who was arrested yesterday. And they can put that up on their own blog. They can send it to the journalist. They can ask the journalist to report on that and to show what's happening. We can ask and demand our institutions install software like NetClean that not only blocks child sex abuse material from being traded, but reports people who attempt to trade in it. So that would take the responsibility out of the institution.
Dr. Lori Handrahan, thank you so much, and thank you for all of the difficult work that you're doing.
Well, thank you very much for your interest and for the interview and for reading the book. I really appreciate it, Bonnie.
Something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Lori Handrahan. Today's show has been America's Traffic in Child Pornography. Lori Handrahan completed her PhD at the London School of Economics and later taught at American University in Washington, D.C. She worked as an independent consultant to the United Nations on Gender Equality. She is the author of Epidemic, America's Trade in Child Rape. Visit her website at lorihandrahan.com. That's LoriHandrahan.com. Epidemic is available from the publisher at trineday.com. That's trineday.com, and from Amazon. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yoramako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we'll be playing with the conflicts between the map and the territory. I'll ramble on for a bit, and then we'll hear parts of a new audio collage by Virtual Renderings. I hope you'll stay tuned. Connecticut is most sincerely snow-covered at the moment, but as recently as Groundhog Day, I was out riding the motorcycle through the forests. I call it Groundhog Day. The corporate media prefers to call the day Super Bowl Sunday. And the corporation that owns American Professional Football demands a license fee to use their registered trademark, Super Bowl. I am pleased to report that I failed to watch the Super Bowl for the XLVIII-th consecutive year. Even as we speak, I am not watching that other corporate entertainment, the Olympics. And I don't know how many Roman numerals to put after that brand name. The NFL probably has the copyright on Roman numerals anyway. But I digress. So on Groundhog Day, I was on the motorcycle, trying to take some unfamiliar back roads down to Middletown. Despite having a pretty good map with me, I got lost 3 times in maybe 50 miles. Well, at least I had a pleasant ride, even when I was good and lost. But I got to thinking about good maps and bad maps, and the imperfect relationship all maps have to the territory they purport to represent. That's what being overeducated does to you. You start thinking, instead of just sitting there watching the Super Bowl. Then I heard the new audio collage put out by Virtual Renderings, and that also inspired thoughts of maps and territories. Or, in other words, the image the establishment is trying to get you to accept is a false picture of reality. Here's a clip from that collage. This is Chris Hedges.
The state, in its internal projections, has a vision of the future that is as dystopian as mine. But the state, to protect itself, uses its mechanisms of propaganda to assure us that we can continue to build a society based on limitless growth, profligate consumption, and a dependence on fossil fuel. The mania for hope is fed at the expense of truth. The corporate state, meanwhile, is preparing secretly for the world it knows is actually coming. It is cementing into place a pervasive police state, one that includes the complete evisceration of our most basic civil liberties and the militarization of the internal security apparatus, as well as the wholesale surveillance of the citizenry. Those with the moral courage to expose this security and surveillance apparatus, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, Jeremy Hammond, are criminalized and persecuted.
Well, there you have it. A phrase that used to be well known goes like this. The map is not the territory. Sounds like a pretty dopey slogan, but the more you look into things, the smarter it seems. The phrase was popularized by S.I. Hayakawa back in the 1950s. Hayakawa was an American scholar of language, a semanticist. Don't confuse S.I. Hayakawa with Suzuki Hayabusa, which is a very fast motorcycle. I never straddled a Hayabusa, but I did read Hayakawa back in about 1975, and his slogan has stuck in my mind ever since. The map is not the territory. Here's what it's saying. People don't respond directly to reality. We respond to our understanding of reality. Our understanding is like a map. The map is made of images and especially of words. There is always a map, but some maps work better than others. A map is how we understand reality. It's a representation of reality. The map represents the territory. And as we move through the world, we go by the map. We perceive and know what the map says more than we perceive and know direct reality. Anybody who's traveled much in his own vehicle, or on his own vehicle, can point out many places where the road does not go where the map says it does, or the town the map shows does not, in fact, exist, or that paved two-lane blacktop the map shows running from Ellington down to Tolland turns out just to be a rutted dirt goat path in the middle. No fun on a big fat Harley-Davidson like mine. Probably no fun on a Suzuki Hayabusa either. Yes, Schnipset Lake Road, I'm talking about you. What we learned in school about how the United States government functions and about the aims of U.S. foreign policy is a map of reality. This very map is further embellished by the corporate-controlled media. And almost everybody is constantly talking and acting as though this map had some close resemblance to reality. The United States is a peace-loving nation, the map says. The main goal of U.S. foreign policy is to promote democracy and human rights throughout the world. The government works to protect the best interests of the citizens. And the economy has recovered from the recession that began in 2008. Part of growing up is getting to the point where you declare, "Wait a minute, this map is wrong. This map does not accurately represent the territory that I've been crossing. Look at that stuff out there that's not on the map. And look at that road that doesn't go where the map says it goes." The people running this society depend on your map being inaccurate. If your map were more accurate, you wouldn't be content. You'd get mad. You'd do your best to throw your rulers in jail and start making changes in the territory. So the rulers hound and persecute especially the whistleblowers. That is, the people who are shouting, "The territory is not what the map says, and look, I've got proof." Attempting to correct the official map is a very bad career move, and hazardous to your health. Just as Chris Hedges said, the people running the show have pursued and persecuted Daniel Ellsberg, Julian Assange, Jeremy Howard, Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden. And does anyone remember Professor Norman Finkelstein? How Noam Chomsky managed to stay alive and prosper for so long is anybody's guess. But don't ever look for his face on public TV, let alone whatever network it was broadcast the Super Bowl. No, attempting to draw a better map is hard and dangerous work. The power elite does not welcome amateur cartographers. As long as you've got a false map, you won't be able to make changes in the territory. That's the whole point of giving you a false map and training you not to doubt it. That's why the people need to redraw their maps. Well, maybe I pushed this metaphor far enough. As I said, I thought of it again while listening to a new audio collage put together by Virtual Renderings, also known as Chaz K. It's about the real state of the Union and how power really works. Chaz K's central metaphor is not maps versus territories. His central metaphor is Leviathan. The title of the collage is Ponderings from Within Leviathan. The piece is an hour long, and I'm just going to play a small part today, starting at the beginning. But the words spoken in this part really reminded me of S.I. Hayakawa and The Map is Not the Territory. Particularly a little talk it has by Jordan Maxwell called How the World Really Works. You'll recognize it when we come to it. It's the part with George Winston's solo piano in the background. Remember the record label Windham Hill? There's a blast from the past. New Age music with beautifully recorded acoustic instruments. Well, when you hear the solo piano, that's it. How the World Really Works by Jordan Maxwell. And I think the other voices we'll hear are playing variations on the same theme. The piece starts with a poem by Woody Harrelson. And there's part of a talk by Chris Hedges. You heard some of that already. And there's some music by Jackson Brown, of all people, and whatnot. Let's hear a bit of Ponderings from Within Leviathan, starting with Woody Harrelson.
I sometimes feel like an alien creature for which there is no earthly explanation. Sure, I have human form, walking erect with opposing digits, but my mind is upside down. I feel like a run-on sentence in a punctuation-crazy world, and I see the world around me like a mad collective dream. An endless stream of people move like ants on the freeway, cell phones, PCs, and digital displays. In money we trust, we'll find happiness, the prevailing attitude. Like a genetically modified irradiated Big Mac is somehow symbolic of food. Morality is legislated, prisons overpopulated, religion is incorporated, the profit motive has permeated all activity. We pay our government to let us park on the street. And war is the biggest money maker of all. We all know missile envy only comes from being small. Politicians and prostitutes are comfortable together. I wonder if they talk about the strange change in the weather. This government was founded by, of, and for the people, but everybody feels it like a giant open sore. They don't represent us anymore. And blaming the president for the country's woes is like yelling at a puppet for the way it sings. Who's the man behind the curtain pulling the strings? A billion people sitting watching their TV in the room that they call living. But as for me, I see living as loving. And since there is no loving room, I sit on the grass under a tree, dreaming of the way things used to be, pre-industrial revolution. Which of course was before the rivers and oceans and skies were polluted, before Parkinson's and mad cows and all the convoluted cacophony of bad ideas like skyscrapers and tree paper and earth rapers like Monsanto and DuPont had their way, as they continue to today. This was pre-us. Back when the buffalo roamed and the Indian's home was the forest and God was nature and heaven was here and now. Can you imagine clean water, food and air, living in community with animals and people who care? Do you dare to feel responsible for every dollar you lay down? Are you going to make the rich man richer or are you going to stand your ground? You say you want a revolution, a communal evolution, to be a part of the solution. Maybe I'll be seeing you around.
Friedrich Nietzsche in Beyond Good and Evil wrote that only a few people have the fortitude to look into what he calls the molten pit of human reality. A handful of artists and philosophers, for Nietzsche, are consumed by an insatiable curiosity, a quest for truth, a desire for meaning, and this sends them down into the bowels of the pit. They get as close as they can before the flames and heat drive them back. This understanding, Nietzsche wrote, comes at a high cost. Those singed by the fire become burnt children, eternal orphans in empires of illusion. Dying civilizations make war on independent intellectual inquiry, art and culture, on the burnt children. The masters of the corporate state do not want us to peer into the pit or heed the cries of those who have seen what awaits us. The corporate state rather feeds the thirst for illusion, happiness, and hope. It peddles the fantasy of endless material progress. It insists, and this is the argument of globalization, that our voyage is unalterable, decreed by natural law. It is part of the march of human progress, and those who challenge this myth are heretics.
In a weapons-producing nation under Jesus, in the fabled crucible of the free world, camera crews search for clues amid the detritus. Entertainment shapes the land the way the hammer shapes the hand. Checkout counter at the Church of Fame. The lucky winners cheer Casino Nation. All those not on TV only have themselves to blame. Don't quite seem to understand.
Human species, led by white Europeans and Euro-Americans, has been on a 500-year-long planet-wide rampage of conquering, plundering, looting, exploiting, and polluting the Earth, as well as killing the indigenous communities that stood in the way. But the game is up. The technological and scientific forces that created a life of unparalleled luxury as well as unrivaled military and economic power for a small global elite, are the forces that now doom us. The capitalist quest for ceaseless economic expansion has become a curse, a death sentence. But even as our economic and environmental systems unravel, after the hottest year in the contiguous 48 states since record-keeping began 107 years ago, we lack the vision and the courage to shut down the engines of global capitalism.
And everywhere the good prepare for perpetual war. Let their weapons shape the plan the way the hammer shapes the hand. The way the hammer shapes the hand. Shakes the hand the way the hammer shakes the hand the way the hammer shakes the hand the way the hammer shakes the hand.
Our family farms have been destroyed by agribusinesses. Monsanto and its Faustian counterparts on Wall Street rule. They are steadily poisoning our lives and rendering us powerless. The corporate leviathan, which is global, is freed from the constraints of a single nation state or government. Corporations are beyond regulation or control. politicians are too anemic, or more often too corrupt, to stand in the way of the accelerating corporate destruction. This makes our struggle different from the revolutionary struggles in industrial societies in the past.
I think the one thing I'd like for you to take away from anything that I say today is this one point, that nothing in this world works the way you think it does. Nothing. The police aren't who you think they are. The sheriff is not who you think he is. Banks do not do what you think they do. Governments don't operate anywhere near the way you think they do. And that's why today, when you look at what's going on in the world today, none of it makes any sense. It's all crazy. It makes no sense at all. It seems very destructive. But actually, in point of fact, you don't know how the system works. It's working perfectly fine. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And the people, the masses, are entertained with television and alcohol and drugs, and the wealthy continue to get wealthy, and so it's working perfectly fine once you understand how the world really works, and nothing works the way you think it does. When you begin to break down how government works, banks work, you begin to see a whole world that you've never known. The word I use is occult. Occult simply means hidden, and this is exactly what is going on in the world today. Our governments, banks, institutions of education, etc., are operating on a totally occult or hidden basis. And so what we are told and given to understand is not the truth. This is why I have no respect. I have a respect, a reasonable respect for law and order. I'm not so stupid as not to understand the need for red lights and the things which are required in law for people to live together. But I have no respect for religion, government, banking, and especially educational institutions, because I know who finances these organizations. I have found that so many people willingly, and as I said last night on this forum, so many people willingly bend themselves to what their masters want from them. What your masters want is for you to be in compliance, for you to think what they have told you to think. The news is nothing more than what somebody and higher up wants you to believe. So that's why I have no respect for the news. I don't watch television. I'm not interested in Hollywood or movies as such. But there is a lot of interesting stuff in movies. Government, again, I say, it's just my belief. I believe government boils down to the war between the Crips and the Bloods. But that's all it is. It's just one gang is superior to another gang. Unless, of course, that other gang gets a little more money and gets a little bit more vicious. Now, they take over town, and so it's a war between gangs, because after all, when it's all boiled down, it boils down to one thing. We're all human, and humans, like Martin Luther King said, people are organizations. Martin Luther King said, organizations are a lot more naughtier than individuals. Individuals can be bad and corrupt. But when you get a whole bunch of individuals bad and corrupt, and they're wearing uniforms and wearing badges, now you've got a gang. And the police department even have said that. You know, they tell me things like that. Yeah, we're the biggest gang in town. We're legal. We can do whatever we want. So I understood a long time ago that government is simply gang warfare. Who's going to run this town? Well, what family in the mob is going to run this area of the town? So that's why I have no respect for government, banking, or any of the rest of it. Religions have been given to us by the same people who gave us our government, our banks, our educational institutions, our whole entire ruddy system in Western civilization is based on religion, politics, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's just business. It's just money. It's just the control of people. And if you think it's crazy when I say sex, you have no idea in the world how sex plays a part in everything. I don't think that the world of mankind can handle the real truth about how the world really works.
The state, in its internal projections, has a vision of the future that is as dystopian as mine. But the state, to protect itself, uses its mechanisms of propaganda to assure us that we can continue to build a society based on limitless growth, profligate consumption, and a dependence on fossil fuel. The mania for hope is fed at the expense of truth. The corporate state, meanwhile, is preparing secretly for the world it knows is actually coming. It is cementing into place a pervasive police state, one that includes the complete evisceration of our most basic civil liberties and the militarization of the internal security apparatus, as well as the wholesale surveillance of the citizenry. Those with the moral courage to expose this security and surveillance apparatus, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, Jeremy Hammond, are criminalized and persecuted.
And we'll end near where we began. You'll find a link to this complete collage by Virtual Renderings on our show's webpage, and that is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, wishing you a safe and sane Washington's birthday, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, and, as motorcyclists say, keep the shiny side up. Ciao.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Well, Happy New Year, everyone. In 2018, we're still living in a post-9/11 world. All of the wars we're in were justified by the lies of 9/11, and we still have troops in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and other countries supposedly fighting the terrorists that the U.S. and some of our allies actually created and are still supporting, funding, arming. I just heard on the news this morning that more U.S. soldiers have died in Afghanistan. The cost of these wars, based on the lies of 9/11, in both human lives and dollars, is overwhelming. And on the domestic front, we have false flag attacks on our own citizens, where many of the alleged perpetrators have connections to the FBI or intelligence agencies, and where most of these events are blamed on Muslims to keep the American people supporting the bogus war on terror, keeping us afraid. Because of the lies of 9/11, we have an ever-encroaching police state. In the U.S., our civil liberties have been severely curtailed. The Constitution is in shreds with mass surveillance of all of us. If you're new to any of this, I encourage you to do your own research. There are now mountains of evidence that what the government and corporate media and some alternative media have told us happened on 9/11 is totally false and fraudulent. So as you do your own research, it's important that you recognize that 99.9% of what the corporate and some of the alternative media sites tell us about 9/11 is totally false and is the real fake news. Luckily for us, the 9/11 truth movement does not give up. Some new things are happening in 2018 in the 9/11 truth movement. And here with me today on the program to discuss one of them is Craig McKee. Craig McKee is a 9/11 researcher and journalist who lives in Canada. He's the secretary for the monthly 9/11 and other deep state events teleconference. He hosts the website truthandshadows.com, and he's joining me today to discuss his recent initiative on the Pentagon. Craig McKee, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Cheryl. I'm glad to be with you.
So you've recently created a list of people who agree with the statement, no 757 hit the Pentagon. Could you tell us a bit about why you created this list and any other details about it?
Sure. I've been thinking for some time. I mean, the Pentagon is generally conceded to be where a lot of the apparent controversy exists in the 9/11 truth movement. There is a small group of researchers, some of whom have familiar names to people in the movement, who have been working for several years now to convince us that a large plane, a 757 specifically, did hit the Pentagon on the official flight path, that it did knock over the five light poles, hit the building, go right through three rings of the building, and make a nice round exit hole at the end. I feel that the evidence is overwhelming that there was no 757 impact, and I felt that because the rest of the movement seems to be a bit divided on specifically what did happen. Some people think it was a missile, some people think it was a global hawk, or perhaps a military plane or a commuter jet. There's all different possibilities, but the thing that everybody has in common, or the majority I think have in common, is that they don't believe it was a 757. So I felt that because there was so much, I guess you could say, division over details, that it was important to bring everyone together under this fundamental statement, which is that a 757 did not hit the Pentagon. Because this way, I personally don't support the missile position, but I know there are people who do, and it's really, I think, unnecessary for us to debate whether one theory or another theory is correct, when really, if we unite under this statement, then really the official story has to be false. If we're right about what we're saying, and if the evidence against the 757 impact is persuasive, then the official story is toast. So that's kind of the theory behind it. And also, I think there was a false impression being given that the group of researchers that I mentioned earlier, that they somehow were gaining ground and that some sort of consensus was forming around their position. And this is only because this is what they claim. They claim that a consensus is forming when I think there is no such consensus on their side. So I felt it was important for people to register their position and to agree on this fundamental point.
I think you've done a great job of getting a position that we could all support, even within having differences about what did hit the Pentagon or not. So I like that. It's a way of uniting us around that one simple point. And it sounds like you've gotten a lot of support for that. Can you tell us who signed it and how many and anything that might be of interest that way?
Yes. The effort started about a month ago. So I actually got the number onto the list even before the list was published. I got it up to about 545 names, which was a lot of work, because I try to include also, you know, a little bit of identifying information, you know, which city people are from, or only country if they prefer. So in that time, since we published about a week ago, we've actually got it up to 670 some odd names, 673, something like that. And some of the, I think, most respected names in the movement have added their names. Among those, David Ray Griffin, who is well known for his, I think, 11 or 12 books that he's written on 9/11, and he's also co-founder of the 9/11 Consensus Panel, although he is not adding his name on behalf of the panel. It's strictly on his own. That's an important point to make. But other people like Niels Harrit, the very well-respected Danish researcher who's given hundreds of presentations about 9/11 over the years, Barbara Honegger, who's known for her Pentagon presentations, Elias Davidson, who's a researcher who originally from Iceland, now living in Germany, who's written the book about 9/11 and all about the four flights, and he's made a very strong case that there's no evidence supporting the idea of hijackers on any of the planes. So there's a whole long list of people who have put their names on this, plus, of course, many, many truthers who haven't written books or anything, but they're still people that are dedicated to finding the truth. So that's where we stand. I hope we have a lot of room to grow. It's not so much a question of how many people agree with the statement as it is how do we reach people.
So you have 673, which is really remarkable in this short amount of time. So what evidence is there that no 757 hit the Pentagon on 9/11?
Well, I think there's a lot and overwhelming evidence. First of all, I believe that the government's claim that there was a 757 impact and that it was Flight 77 specifically, I believe that the burden of proof is on those who make that assertion. So I think they have to prove that this did happen, and I think this is what they are actually not capable of doing. But let's look at some of the things. The most obvious thing, the first thing I think that is inescapable is the fact that there are no large pieces of wreckage that were left outside the Pentagon on that day. And I mean none. When I talk about large pieces of wreckage, I'm talking about something larger than what you could toss in the back of a pickup truck. I don't consider that to be large wreckage. If you can pick it up and walk across the lawn with it in your hand, it's not large wreckage. The official story claims that the plane came in slightly banked to the left and that the right engine clipped a generator trailer on the way in. Now, this would put the right wing impact entirely on the second floor of the building, and there's no hole there. Actually, one of the people who's added his name to our list, another Canadian scientist named A.K. Dewdney, he's the person who did the study of the cell phone calls to show that cell phone calls would have been impossible from the planes at any altitude back in 2001. Anyway, he also did another paper talking about the wings and how the wings, had the plane actually hit the building, that the wings would not have folded in, as some allege, but would have snapped off. And certainly the right wing, there's simply no hole there. Where did the wing go? If the plane hit the building, where did the wing go? the tail section would have hit. I'll mention what the hole looks like, actually, to those who don't know. On the second floor, there's a small hole, maybe 15 or 16 feet wide, with a column going right down the middle of it. And this is supposed to be where the fuselage entered. And on the ground floor, there is a damaged section that's something in the area of 90 feet wide, but only an uninterrupted opening that's about 50 feet. There are still some columns kind of in the way that are hanging, at least, beyond that 50 feet. So the tail section would have hit above this second floor hole. And the windows directly in the path of the tail are not even broken. And this seems to be impossible. If you've got a plane coming in, and it's supposed to have come in at 530 miles per hour, which is incredibly fast. I'll also mention the fact that there were some extremely credible and compelling witnesses interviewed by a group called Citizen Investigation Team that put the path of the plane entirely up to the north of the Citgo gas station, which was across the street. And this path, and they also, when they drew the path on a photograph they were given, an aerial photograph, they pretty much all drew a right bank to the plane. And these people were in different places. Some of them worked at the gas station. Some of them were cops who were stopping for gas. Some worked at the cemetery. And yet they all saw the same path. And this path is completely irreconcilable with the physical damage. If the plane was north of the gas station, it could not have hit the light poles that it is alleged to have knocked over. In fact, two of the witnesses that CIT interviewed couldn't even see the plane for most of its approach had it been on the official path. William Lagacy is a Pentagon cop. The canopy of the gas station would have been blocking his view of a plane coming in on the official path. So he clearly describes that it was on a different path. Leaves the inescapable conclusion that the damage was staged.
So people in the movement, some think there was a plane there, but it was higher and it didn't hit the building.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are, as I said earlier, there are different theories that people have who don't believe a plane impact occurred. But certainly I'm one of the people who believes that the evidence is very strong that a plane did approach the building, that it didn't hit. In fact, the flight data recorder, the National Transportation Safety Board, released an animation based on the data from the flight data recorder. And that animation shows the plane on the north side of the Citgo gas station and also too high to have hit the building. So the government's own evidence undermines their own claim that the plane came in on the south path and hit the building.
And if a 757 was going at 530 miles per hour and was so low to the ground, as this one supposedly was, in order to be able to hit the first floor of the Pentagon, wouldn't there be something called the ground effect that would make it fall apart before it could actually hit the building?
Yeah, that's something I know a lot of people have pointed that out, and it's not something I've studied the science of closely, so I'm not sure I would be the best one to try to argue for that, but certainly that claim has been made. The speed of the plane as well, you know, it's the government saying that it was 530 miles per hour. We don't really have any independent confirmation of that. In fact, some of the witnesses that CIT interviewed had the plane going considerably slower than that. But the government's claim is 530, so that I think they have to defend that. If they're going to claim that that's what the speed was, then I think they have to deal with the ground effect issue that you're raising. It does seem impossible to think that a plane could be going that speed. And also, there's another thing to know as well, and that's that the official flight path would go right through Virginia Department of Transportation a tower, which is 169 feet high. And it was within a couple of thousand feet, 2,400 feet, I think, of the Pentagon. So for that plane, Pilots for 9/11 Truth has done a study on this, and for the plane to have flown above that tower, and then it would have to descend so fast in order to hit the first light pole that the G-forces would have been impossible for the plane to pull out of that dive and then to go across parallel to the ground, just a few feet above the ground, and into the building. So there's a big problem with that. And there's also the video that a lot of us have seen that shows some kind of a blur. But if you watch Massimo Mizuko's film called September 11, The New Pearl Harbor, he shows some research by another Italian researcher that the two views that we have seen, because they're almost from identical angles, one was inside of a parking booth and one was in a barrier right in front of the booth. So they were almost identical, and they were synchronized using what's called a multiplexer. And you can see that the frames match up just by the shape of the smoke cloud. But there's only one frame of the two pairs that doesn't match up, that should match up, and that's the one with the alleged plane in it. So this indicates, I think, clearly that one or both of these pieces of video were doctored, because we should have seen the same thing from just a slightly different angle.
Yeah, I've seen that video. I think we've showed it here at the college, Mazzucco's film about the new Pearl Harbor. And that's where I learned that thing about the ground effect. And then there's also the pilot, Hani Hanjour, who they said did this, who was supposedly flying that plane. And, of course, according to all of his flight school teachers, he was the worst pilot they'd ever seen and that kind of thing. I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Well, sure. I mean, some of the flight schools he dealt with, one of them wanted to know whether his pilot's license actually was genuine. They actually doubted that it was actually genuine because he was such a poor pilot. He was refused rental of a Cessna two-seater plane a month before 9/11. There was even inquiries made by one flight school about whether his piloting license should be revoked because he was so bad. One of them said, I can't remember the name of the person who said it, but they said basically he could not fly at all. His skills were so poor. And this is a person who is supposed to have flown for the first time in his life a Boeing 757.
Yeah, making that miraculous turn at such a high speed.
The spiral descent, yeah.
I think most thinking people do not believe the government's official account of this. But you had mentioned earlier that you think the burden of proof falls on them, on the government. And I agree with you on that. But what have they shown about the Pentagon? There's supposedly like 80 or more cameras at the Pentagon, and they haven't released nearly all of those videos, if there were any, of a supposedly plane hitting. I don't know if you have any information on that you want to add?
Well, just there were Freedom of Information requests made for that, and the government, the answer that came back was that there was only the one camera view, or I guess the two, because they were almost the same, that would have captured a plane. I don't know the exact wording they used, whether it was did capture a plane, and they also confiscated all the video from the surrounding businesses within 10 minutes of the event. All that video was scooped up.
Never to be seen again.
You know, some of it's been released, but it doesn't show a plane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this one, I think it's from the DoubleTree Hotel, where you can see in the background, you can see the explosion and you can see the big smoke cloud going up, but you don't see a plane. So, yeah, basically they have not shown. I mean, there should be tons of video that would, had there been a real plane, the Pentagon has so many cameras. And the assertion made by some people that, well, they only shot at one frame per second, and so it's not surprising it wouldn't capture it. I mean, this is an absurd, absurd claim. It's the Pentagon, for God's sake. Are people really asserting that your corner convenience store has better surveillance, video surveillance, than the Pentagon? It's ridiculous.
Exactly. And I think, I can't imagine that on a building like the Pentagon, they must have had even some kind of a weapon system on the roof of it or something for just that kind of a thing happening.
Yeah, I don't know that that's ever been completely proven, but there's certainly a lot of indications that they did have that. We know for a fact that the White House did. It had surface air missiles. So
right,
the
think
idea that the Pentagon would not is kind of hard to swallow.
I agree. So tell us this apparent controversy, as you call it, within the 9/11 truth movement about the Pentagon. What are some of the evidence that the opposing people have, if you've studied that a little bit? Do they have any convincing evidence for what they're saying, that it was a 757?
Not as far as I'm concerned, no. In fact, they basically echo the government's position on almost everything. I mean, of course, they're quick to point out that they don't agree with the official story, and they don't think Hani Hanjour was flying the plane and all that. But beyond that, they pretty much, as far as I can see, kind of rush in to prop up that story. And when strong evidence emerges that is beneficial to the truth movement, because it pokes a hole in that official story, this group seems to be more concerned with going after the new evidence than it does going after the official story. So I think there's a big issue with that. The latest thing is that the claim is being made that Lloyd England, who's the taxi driver who's cab was supposedly hit by a pole, knocked over, which is a completely ridiculous story as well. But they're claiming that, you know, all the way along, the story has been that this first light pole that the plane supposedly came in contact with, that the pole got hit by the plane's right wing and was knocked into his cab. But in fact, the story doesn't hold up at all, because first of all, the plane was crossing the highway, so the pole somehow had to get through the fuselage of the plane as it was going across the highway. And plus, it was hit by the right wing, which, because it's not perpendicular to the plane, it's kind of back, the pole should have gone forward and to the right, but instead it goes 150 feet up the road to the left and impales England's cab, supposedly, and leaves a hole, which you can see in photograph, that you would have a hard time getting a tennis ball through the hole in the upholstery, allegedly made by this more than 20-foot long pole hurtling through the air after being hit by a plane going 530 miles per hour. Not only is that completely ridiculous, but even the idea that the wings of the plane could hit five light poles at that speed and not rupture and not explode before even getting to the Pentagon, kind of unbelievable.
Yeah, and then if this light pole supposedly went through Lloyd England's window and he comes out unscathed and he's out walking around, doesn't make sense to me either.
Not only is he unscathed, but the hood, I mean, the thing that supposedly went through the windshield and stuck into the back seat, the hood doesn't have a scratch on it. And the story is that he stopped the car, and some guy in a van stopped and helped him pull the pole out of the car. Why he would do this immediately after this event is kind of beyond me. And how, I mean, this is a man that was in his late 60s at the time. So why they would, I don't even know if they physically could do that. I highly doubt it, but certainly why they would do it is a mystery. And the group that I'm talking about, this group of researchers, is now saying, oh, it wasn't the first pole, it was the second pole that was on the other side of the plane, and it was just the small part of the pole. Even though Lloyd England has been absolutely clear that it's the long part of the pole, the part that is attached to the ground, he said it many times, and now this particular group is trying to convince us that they're trying to change the story so that it fits the evidence better. And I think that's wrong.
And we also know, due to the great research of Barbara Honegger, that there were explosions going off in the Pentagon that morning.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something Barbara has talked about for many years now. And there's people inside the Pentagon who smelled cordite. Several people reported that. There's the explosion that April Gallup experienced. And her office was well to the north of the alleged impact point. There's also a part of the foundation in the path of what would have been in the path of the plane, in the damage path, that was blown up as if from below. And this is even mentioned in the Pentagon building performance report. So there's no particular explanation for how that could have happened. There's also no explanation for the round searing hole, because the plane clearly would have lost, even that report I just mentioned, that the plane would have completely lost structural integrity before it even went past halfway to that hole. So how does a plane that's been ripped to shreds, allegedly, create a round exit hole? Makes no sense.
Right, it doesn't make any sense. Craig, if somebody wanted to sign your list of people who agree with the statement, no 757 hit the Pentagon, how could they go about doing that?
Well, there's a couple of different ways. They can go to the website, which is truthandshadows.com, and the current post is the list itself with an introduction that I wrote, but below my introduction you'll see the full list, all 673 names or whatever it is exactly. So you can just go to the bottom of that, go to the comments at the bottom and just put your name in there, and ideally maybe the city you live in, just so we can give the list a little more meat to it than just by, you know, just putting names. So, yeah, if you're just put the city and state or whatever. And you can also email me at truthandshadows@yahoo.com. And we also have a Facebook group that's been created with over 600 members, more than 600 members. And that group is called, appropriately, No 757 Hit the Pentagon on 9/11. So you're welcome to join that group, and you can leave a comment there that says you'd like to be added to the list. So hopefully there are enough different ways that people can do it, or they can send me a private message on Facebook, Craig McKee, and I'll make sure that they get added to the list. I hope we can make this as big as possible so that we can be as, I guess, united as it is possible to be in opposition to the official story of what happened at the Pentagon.
Exactly. And you know, this group that is saying that it was a large plane or a 757, one of the things that kind of rubbed me the wrong way about it is that they wrote an article saying that now this is the definitive proof that whatever, I don't remember their exact words, but it was to that effect that this is the definitive proof of the Pentagon that there was this large plane. And it's just a couple guys writing this article, so it's kind of arrogant to say we have the definitive proof here.
But, yeah.
And we see that there's only like a few of them who have backed this view, and that you have created this list with over now 673 people. So I think that it shows that they don't have a lot of support in their views for this. And I'm not knocking anybody who wants to do research, and they may believe in what they're saying, but to say that it's the definitive proof, I think, is on the side of arrogance. Anyway, so I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that. Or...
Well, I just agree with you. I mean, there's an article by a guy named John Wyndham where the headline is Bringing Closure to the Debate About the Pentagon, or words to that effect, but bringing closure. In other words, he's ending the discussion because it's an exercise in spin is the best way I can put it. They use manipulative language to try to convince us that a consensus is forming around their view, and this is absolutely false.
Yeah. And, you know, I really like a few of the people that are in that minority group, and they're entitled to their beliefs, but I do think that the way you're handling it, where you're having people sign up and they can agree or not agree, but you're not forcing an opinion down someone's throat, you know, and so I appreciate that.
No, and I think that you see the benefits of it, because when we have discussions in the Facebook group, people aren't fighting about whether it was a missile or the plane flew over or some other possible theory. You know, Barbara Honegger and I, we don't agree about, you know, everything about what happened, but we agree on the fundamental point. So we can be allies. Instead of being in different camps debating, we can be on the same team, you know, standing up for this fundamental statement. That's, I think, the benefit of doing this.
Right. It creates a strength in the movement, I think. And also, it's a strong stance to say, no, the 757 didn't hit the Pentagon. You know, that's our belief based on evidence. As a united front, I think it unites us in a way that we've never been united.
I mean, that's right. I mean, to have a plane crash, you need a plane, and they don't have a plane.
Right.
They have a few scraps outside that just seem to appear kind of in the middle of the lawn that one wonders exactly how they got there.
Mm-hmm.
Small pieces of fuselage that just happened to show part of an American Airlines letter from the fuselage. There's no just plain silver. It's always got that part of one of the letters so that you really know it came from a plane. You know,
right,
sarcastic.
Right.
But, yeah, I think the evidence is overwhelming, and I don't really understand why people in the movement would spend years trying to convince us that the government's crash impact scenario is actually correct. It's a mystery to me.
And, you know, they've had an opportunity to present their information, and then let's leave it at that, but it's like it's a continual push to push that, and I don't understand that either. Anyway, Craig McKee, is there anything we haven't discussed today that you'd like to say to our listening audience before we have to pause?
I think we've covered it pretty well. I think if anybody listening is willing to join the effort, the more names we have on there, then I think the stronger it is, and the more of a unified front that we can present that is definitively against the official story, I think that'll just be such a positive thing. So I just hope that some of your listeners will get in touch and add their names, and if, at the very least, if they want to just go and look at the list, see who's on there, they can do that at truthandshadows.com. So
truthandshadows.com, and your email is?
truthandshadows@yahoo.com.
Okay, and then the Facebook page?
The Facebook page, it's called No 757 Hit the Pentagon on 9/11. So if you do a search for that, you can just ask to join the group, and I'm sure we'll approve you right away and get you in there, and you can see what other people are saying about the evidence. Different people are posting different aspects of it. So far, it's a very civil discussion, even though, you know, not everybody agrees about every detail. It's an indication that we're on the right track, I think.
So I want to thank you, Craig, for all the energy you put into that effort and are still doing. And thanks for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Anytime, Cheryl.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with 9/11 activist, journalist, and researcher Craig McKee. His website is truthandshadows.com. And you can sign the statement that no 757 hit the Pentagon at that website. And again, it's truthandshadows.com. So start your new year off doing something positive for 9/11 truth. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. An escalating legal battle played out in the case of Ravi Ragbir, executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition, an immigrant rights activist whose detention on Thursday by federal immigration authorities sparked protests that led to the arrest of 18 people, including members of the New York City Council. Ravi Ragbir, the executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition of New York City, had shown up for a check-in with Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Thursday morning at the Jacob Javits Federal Building in Lower Manhattan and was then detained. Here to speak with us about the case of Ravi Ragbir is Amy Gottlieb, the Associate Regional Director for the Northeast Region of the American Friends Service Committee, who in this role is responsible for supporting programs in the Northeast region that focus on immigrant rights, and she is the wife of Ravi Ragbir.
Thanks so much, Mimi.
You know, exactly at this time last week, we were speaking with Reverend Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of the New Sanctuary Coalition, about the case of Jean Montrevel, a co-founder of the New Sanctuary Coalition also, who was detained by ICE and sent to the Chrome Detention Center in Florida. And we were encouraging our listeners to show up for the Jericho Walk to encircle the federal building and walk in visual and spiritual and actual support of our brother and sister immigrants called to check in with ICE and who, like Ravi, many might not have been able to check out. So there's a terrible, painful irony in doing the program today. But let's begin in earnest by giving us the status right now of your husband, our executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition and one of the leading activists in the immigrants' rights movement in the country. What's happening right now?
Yeah. Thanks for asking, Mimi. Right now, Ravi is detained in Miami at the Chrome Detention Center. He was brought there on Thursday afternoon, very quickly after he had been brought to a hospital. He had actually fainted during the ICE check-in when they told him that they were going to be, quote, enforcing removal and putting him in custody. So they were required to take him to a hospital, and right directly from the hospital, unbeknownst to us, we had no idea, he was taken to Newark Airport and flown to Chrome, where he continues to be. there was a hearing yesterday. We are asking at a minimum that he be brought up back to the New York area so that he can be close to family, to his legal counsel, to his community. And of course, that, you know, our ultimate desire is that he be released, but at a minimum, we want him brought closer to here. So we had a hearing yesterday in federal court. We do not have a decision from that case. We hope to have that in the next day or two, hopefully today. And we're hoping to have a decision that says that that ICE has to bring him back to his community.
And then, as we mentioned earlier, there is Gene as well. And what I'm wondering is your thoughts about whether or not there is also a targeting of activists in the immigrants' rights sphere and members of the New Sanctuary Coalition.
Yeah, at this point, maybe I don't think there can be a doubt that there is a connection and that there's targeting and retaliation against people who have been willing to dissent, who've been willing to say that ICE practices are unconscionable and unfair. We have Ravi, we have Gene, we have Maru in Seattle, who is being placed into deportation proceedings right now, a very outspoken activist who's done a lot of work on detention issues out there. So there's no coincidence that in the span of a week or a week and a half, we're seeing three leaders being specifically targeted by ICE. And it's extraordinarily troubling. And the manner in which they're doing it is, it's pretty, it's despicable, honestly, you know, snatching people away from their families.
And of course, we've seen throughout the country and certainly in New York, many on Long Island, 7-Elevens that have mm-hmm. been raided. And I remember when I was a kid, really, in Junior's restaurant in Brooklyn and a big restaurant in Sheepshead Bay called Lundy's, when there actually used to be ICE raids in the kitchens there. And mm-hmm. you would see people scattering for their very lives as ICE was rounding up people in the most punitive manner and just literally snatching them. I've always thought of them as a kind of body snatchers. And I want mm-hmm. You to talk a little bit about, obviously that's happening again, but the whole question of unjust detention.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have this network of, you know, a couple hundred facilities throughout the country that are a combination of privately run, federally run, and county jails that contract with the federal government that are holding immigrants, right? We have probably about 40,000 immigrants per day who are locked up solely on immigration violations. So where Ravi is at Crome, it's overcrowded. The first 3 or 4 days that he was there, he didn't have a bed. He had a cot. We just keep packing people into this system. We're paying a ton of money for it, and, you know, ranging from around $90 to $150 per bed per day, per person per day to the federal government. And then private prisons, of course, are making money off of this, or private contractors that, if the prison itself is not private, the contracting services inside, the phone company, the commissary, the medical, those are all the guards often are contracted out. So, you know, there are private companies that are making money off of this as families are torn apart. And it was telling for me when I went to Crome to visit Ravi over the weekend. And, you know, people are held so far. We don't know, of course, who all the people in Crome are. A lot of them are recent arrivals from Central America. But on the Sunday morning at 9:30, when I had my appointment to go in and have a family visit through plexiglass, I was one of only about five people who were there visiting their loved ones. And that really struck me that, you know, somehow these people are so isolated that people either are not able to get to visit them or they don't have contacts in this community. And so we have this web of systems where, you know, we're tearing people apart from the world that they've lived in. And, you know, for those who are recent arrivals, many of them are fleeing violence, severe violence, have been victims of trauma, sexual assault, and, you know, have their freedom taken away, their jails.
I remember so well some years back, Amy, when I was listening to you make a presentation and one of your very, very forceful arguments where you described the issue of people being referred to as illegal and how it divides communities and, of course, dehumanizes immigrants. And it also has the other effect when you describe the issue of immigration as one of legality, of militarization of the borders and so on. I wonder if you can talk more about that whole perspective just to really give a sense of the fact that there is a war on migrants. There is a war on refugees. There is a war on immigrants who, of course, were, along with slave labor, the backbone, and along with indigenous people, are what constitute the working class of this country.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember that exact presentation that I gave, but that is something I've talked about for many years. And, but it, you know, it's funny because it's tragic and sad, but at this point, you know, that feels so far away. We have been, I think, scrambling to keep up with our narrative because we're facing so much demonization, dehumanization, militarization. I mean, what has exploded over the last 2 years, I would say, and I attribute a lot of this to, you know, some of the presidential campaign language, that, you know, we've sort of gotten to a place where we have to defend against, you know, people who are calling other countries holes, or who are, you know, calling people from Mexico rapists, or, you know, what have you, that we're in this position of having to defend that, so that the conversation about illegal has gotten a little bit buried. And I think it's a really important one, and I'm glad you're raising it, because, you know, we do have this system where we have set up this divide. We've created a system where nobody is willing to sort of look at the deeper roots of migration, why people are migrating, what are the conditions that cause people to make a decision to leave their families, as if that's something, you know, simple to do. You know, what are, and also, what are the conditions that allow us to reach a point where our government officials, and I include many of our government officials in that, are forced to put up a wall and dehumanize themselves in order to take these actions against immigrant communities, so that there's dehumanization on all sides. You know, and the militarization that we talk about is just, it's rampant. It's everywhere. It's, you know, when Ravi was, taken to the hospital and then taken to the airport, he was accompanied, when he was in the hospital, I think he said there were 8 ICE agents with him, 8 ICE agents with somebody seeking medical treatment who had fainted during an ICE interview. And we had NYPD there also. So, you know, there's really big questions about how we're targeting people and what we are sort of becoming as a nation when the violence has become the norm, right? State violence has become the norm. And I feel very, very, very strongly that what happened to Ravi and what happened to me last Thursday with the treatment that we received, those were violent, violent acts imposed upon us by our federal government.
And of course, one of the reasons that Ravi was so successful and respected so much as the executive director of the New Sanctuary Coalition was because he also has firsthand knowledge of the deportation system, because he was facing removal. He's been fighting it to remain here with his family, his friends, his supporters, his wife, yourself. And I want you to talk a little bit within that about the whole question of the unjust detention and the process, which is rife with problematic as well, which very few people have a chance to focus on and understand.
Well, you know, Ravi is a person who's gone through this now. I mean, it's been 15 years since he was originally convicted of a wire fraud crime, more than that, 18 years since he was convicted of a crime. He's been fighting his deportation since 2006. It's a hard case. But as we go through this, you know, when we were told on Thursday last week that he was being taken into custody, it's like your entire world gets cut off from you. You know, he made a clear decision to be public about what he was facing. And that was, we knew that was a risk. He also made a clear decision not to hide from this, not to, you know, go into sanctuary, and not to say that's not the right thing for certain people. But for Robbie, that wasn't the right thing. He really wanted to see where this played out in a public way and turn himself in and hope that, you know, ICE would do the right thing. So we went in last Thursday not really expecting that he'd be taken in based on some conversations that had happened previously. And when we were sitting there and they said they were going to take him in, it was like our entire world turned upside down, right? I mean, honestly, you know, he was not given any chance to, you know, even take care of basic things in his life that might have needed to be taken care of. Because you're just literally taken away. And then to make it so much worse, they take him 1,000 miles away where his lawyers are not accessible. I'm not accessible. Other family members and friends are not accessible. So, you know, this idea that locking people up, jailing, this, you know, sort of major contributor to the additional expansion of mass incarceration is, it's what our government is relying on, and it's where we need to put our efforts to fight back, because it is, you know, it's devastating on so many levels to so many people. And, you know, as my dad was saying to Robbie the other day, you know, this is not something that just impacts Amy and Robbie. This is something that has way deeper impact across our family, across our community, across activism, across people who are wanting to, you know, come out and be open about their stories. And the government is using detention as a major weapon.
And of course, there's no accountability. You've expressed the brutalization as part of the process, the unjust detention, the targeting of activists, and the issue of accountability, which seems not to exist in any meaningful way. And I know that you have a hard time to leave us with other appointments. So I want you to talk a little bit about accountability, and then most significantly, what we can do as we stand up. That's what our audiences do when they listen to people like yourself. What do we do to support Ravi Ragbir, Executive Director of the New Sanctuary Coalition, and make sure that he stays with his families, his friends, his community, and continues to do the enormously important work of supporting immigrants' rights, which is absolutely essential at this particular point in history?
Well, I agree with that. In terms of accountability, you know, unfortunately, a lot of what ICE is doing is within the law, right? I mean, they have discretion to not detain at times. They have discretion to not deport. They have discretion to issue stays of removal, but they're not doing it. They were doing it, and they're not doing it anymore. So I think there are opportunities for us to really be witnessing, paying attention, participate in accompaniment, so that we all know what's going on and we can push our legislators to make fundamental changes in the law so that ICE does not have this untethered authority to just keep locking people up and deporting people without accountability. So I think, you know, as much as you can pay attention, be involved, New Sanctuary has, you know, opportunities to support immigrants who are going into check-ins, who are going into immigration court. Pay attention, understand the system, visit people in detention, write to people in detention. New Sanctuary is continuing its efforts to raise awareness of this through Jericho walks and rallies and vigils. There's another one tomorrow at 11 a.m. in front of Federal Plaza, and then another vigil tomorrow evening at 5 p.m. at Varick Street Detention Center on Varick and Houston. So there are opportunities to be present in this and to show up and to share that, you know, get this information out there, bring folks out. I mean, we've seen such a surge of support when Ravi was taken in on Thursday. I mean, you know, what happened in the streets was just, I think, the beginning or a new beginning of increased movement towards, you know, we're going to change this system.
And just lastly, tell us again where we're going to be tomorrow at one or both of those times.
Tomorrow in front of 26 Federal Plaza at 11 a.m., meet at Foley Square, and 5 p.m. at the corner of Varick and Houston Street in front of 201 Varick Street
at
5.
Amy, are there any letters to be sent in particular support of Ravi Ragbir?
Yeah, there. You can go to the website. It's www.ravidefense.wordpress.com. And there's a lot of information about how you can contact legislators, who you can write to, ICE officers. There's postcards you can download and share on social media. There's plenty of things that you can be doing right now, and we're very grateful for it.
Well, we're going to let you go. We're going to continue to pay close attention to this. Certainly, we will be at the Varick Street Detention Center tomorrow and at Federal Plaza. Amy, we wish you and your family well, and our dear brother, Ravi Ragbir, picked up by ICE, must come home to his community, must come home to his family, and continue to do the excellent work that the New Sanctuary Coalition has been doing, and all of us have to get on board with this. It is the critical civil rights issue of our time right now. And we have been speaking with Amy Gottlieb, the Associate Regional Director of the Northeast Region of the American Friends Service Committee and wife of Ravi Ragbir, our dear brother, who we want home now. Amy, thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much, Mimi.
You can have all the money in your hand, all the possessions anyone can ever have, but it's all worthless treasure. True worth is only measured not by what you got, but what you got in your heart. You can have everything, but what does it need? It all means who's looking back at you. Define the life you're living, not by what you take, but what you're keeping. And if you bet on love, there's no way you'll ever lose. Take a stand, make a stand for what's right. It's always worth, always worth the fight. It all means nothing, yeah, and if you don't stand up for something, you can't just...
Absolutely, stand up for something. Audra Day and Common, after that poignant piece with Amy Gottlieb about Ravi Ragbir. Stand up for something.
Dozens of supporters leaning on a federal detention center's wall Thursday night in Soho, where immigration agents are believed to be holding well-known community immigration advocate Ravi Ragbir.
They are retaliating against people who dare to say that this is a bad system, and Ravi dared to say that this is a bad system.
This was Ragbir's worst fear, that a 17-year-old nonviolent federal wire fraud conviction, for which he already served 5 years in a detention center and prison, would one day lead to his deportation back to his native Trinidad, where he hasn't lived in 30 years.
What are your thoughts on this upcoming meeting?
We are absolutely terrified.
This is what Ragbir told us last year during our first interview, in which he did not want to be identified, conducted just weeks after President Trump's inauguration. Weeks later, Ragbir came face to face with the administration's more aggressive enforcement of federal immigration policy and was told to start gathering his travel documents.
My spirit feels heavy, very heavy right now.
Fast forward to Thursday morning's routine ICE check-in, and Ragbir was detained. He fainted upon hearing the news. A rally outside quickly turned into a full-blown protest in which 18 people were arrested, including New York City Councilman Yadanis Rodriguez and Jamani Williams.
Our orange man in the White House claims that he's getting rid of violent murderers and rapists and things of that nature, but he's not. He's getting rid of the Ravi Ragbirs of the world, while making our city better.
Federal immigration officials weighed in on Ragbir's case, releasing a statement which reads in part, quote, "In an exercise of discretion, the agency had previously allowed him to remain free from custody with periodic check-ins while his case was under court review. He has since exhausted his petitions and appeals through the immigration courts, the Board of Immigration Appeals, and the U.S. District Court. He will remain in custody pending removal to Trinidad." We spoke with Ragbir's attorney, and she says that contrary to the statement from ICE, that her client still does have legal options which have not been decided. Yet she still concedes that it has always been the case, and it still could be, that Ragbir's presence and ability to continue living in the United States will depend on the government's discretion.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap. Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
Me is a novel about difference in the midst of sameness. The ant is eccentric, and the ice cream man is gay.
The B in LGBTQ signifies that bisexual people are part of the queer community, but asking us to pick and choose parts of our identity, to constantly prove that we're queer, that we exist, can make us feel like outsiders.
We're stronger together, we're stronger together.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. India's top corp fast-track sex law review, can buys buy a break in the queer community, and singing out to support gay Chechens. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending January 20th, 2018. The January 8th decision by India's Supreme Court to revisit its own ruling in 2013 that reinstated the anti-gay British-era statute outlawing sexual acts against the order of nature seems to be on a fast track. According to media reports this week, the review of Penal Code Section 377 is set for early March by a five-judge panel, with a verdict expected soon thereafter. It follows an August 2017 ruling by the court that, for the first time, found a right to privacy in Article 21 of India's Constitution. That provision states that no person shall be deprived of his life or personal liberty except according to a procedure established by law. That August ruling even cited Section 377 as an example of laws subject to review based on the court's new right to privacy decision. India's National Council of Churches, which represents some 14 million congregants, published an open letter this week supporting the abolition of Section 377. Homosexuality and homoeroticism have been practiced in India from time immemorial, the letter says, noting that homosexual activity was never condemned or criminalized in ancient India. Almost one in five LGBTQ people on Earth live in India.
A three-judge panel in Kenya is reviewing that country's criminal ban on private consensual adult gay sex. Section 165 of the Eastern African Nations Penal Code punishes men who have sex with men, what it calls gross indecency, with up to 14 years in prison. A few cases challenging the statute have been consolidated, and those seeking its abolition began their case this week. Senior counsel Paul Muite told the court that he would be calling a psychiatrist to explain the nature of sexual orientation and other experts to present reports demonstrating biological and even social conditions that influence sexual orientation. Muite argues that Section 165 violates provisions of the Constitution that guarantee the right to equality, freedom from discrimination, human dignity, and the right to privacy. The Kenya Christian Professional Forum, which is reportedly funded by anti-queer U.S. evangelical groups, is opposing decriminalization. Its lawyer, Charles Kanjama, promised to call two witnesses, a psychiatrist and a sociologist, to support its position. According to Kenya's Capital FM, the Attorney General, who's been named as a respondent in the case, has until the hearing resumes on February 22nd to weigh in.
The government of Indonesia, home to the world's largest Muslim population, wants Google to block about 70 queer social networking apps currently downloadable from the country's Google Play Store. They include Blued, a gay male dating and social networking app that claims 27 million users around the world. The government has no control over private mobile apps like Google Play, though it can try to block Google Play's website version. The request by the Communications Ministry to the giant conglomerate appears to be just another wrinkle in the government's crackdown on LGBT people that began in 2016, fueled by inflammatory and usually false and homophobic allegations by religious leaders and high-ranking public officials. While equality supporters celebrated a ruling by Indonesia's constitutional court in December that rejected an effort to outlaw all forms of sex outside of heterosexual marriage, authorities continue to use the country's strict but ambiguous pornography laws to harass and arrest sexual and gender minorities. Google has not yet responded publicly to the government request.
The people of Northern Ireland may soon be asked to vote on marriage equality. They could echo their counterparts in the Republic of Ireland, who overwhelmingly approved opening the civil institution to same-gender couples in 2015. The last major UK territory without marriage equality has virtually been without a government since a power-sharing agreement between the majority Democratic Unionist Party and the leading minority Sinn Féin Party collapsed a year ago, primarily over the issues of local language rights and marriage equality. Three senior unionist officials this week called for a referendum on the issues that are causing the stalled negotiations. They specifically listed whether or not a standalone Irish Language Act for Northern Ireland should be enacted, if civil marriage should be open to same-gender couples, and if strict laws against abortion should be relaxed. David McNary, David Campbell, and Michael McGimpsey announced their Breaking the Deadlock proposal at a January 18th press conference. A statement emphasized that none of us have electoral ambitions and we represent no parties in making this proposal. We offer it as a possible solution in good faith and hope it is accepted as such. Speaking to the press this week, the UK government's new Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Karen Bradley, rebuffed requests by queer campaigners to intervene. While noting her strong support for marriage equality, she insisted that the issue is a matter for the people of Northern Ireland.
In our weekly watch on the pending bill to overturn marriage equality in the British Overseas Territory of Bermuda, there are no updates. Lawmakers overturned the Caribbean nation's May Supreme Court-ordered marriage equality ruling in December and replaced it with less-than-equal civil partnerships for same-gender couples. But British Governor to Bermuda John Rankin must issue royal assent before any legislation on the island can become law, something he has yet to do as we record this newscast. Royal assent is almost always a formality, but Rankin could provoke a local crisis if he refuses to sign off on the legislation as the Queen's official representative. He's been talking with the British Foreign Office about what to do. The government has, of course, supported marriage equality for several years, so the cauldron continues to boil. Meanwhile, Bermuda-based P&O Cruise Lines has canceled romantic wedding-at-sea marriages already booked for later this year by several gay and lesbian couples because of the ongoing legal uncertainties.
The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump continues to wage war on the country's sexual and gender-variant minorities. The Department of Health and Human Services announced this week that it is creating an office to protect the religious rights of healthcare providers, including those who oppose a woman's right to choose or whose beliefs reject marriage equality or being transgendered. The new division will be part of the agency's Office for Civil Rights, which enforces federal anti-discrimination and privacy laws. The National LGBTQ Task Force joined a number of other queer rights groups to condemn the administration's bias-based initiative. "We are not fooled," the statement said. "The new office is meant to make it easier for people to discriminate, not to protect people of faith. No one should be denied care for being who they are."
The Trump Education Department's Office for Civil Rights has reportedly told each of at least three trans students that it is no longer acting on gender identity-based discrimination complaints. The Obama administration argued that federal civil rights laws that ban discrimination based on sex extend to bias based on sexual orientation or gender identity. The Trump administration said last year that such issues should be decided at the local level.
Meanwhile, transgender whistleblower Chelsea Manning has already met with some criticism for her announcement that she'll be challenging the re-election bid of Maryland's popular two-term Democratic incumbent, Senator Ben Cardin, as the more progressive choice in a June party primary. According to local reports, however, neither has filed a formal declaration of candidacy yet with the State Elections Board.
And finally, it's taken a while, but Helen Grace James received word this week that her 1955 discharge from the U.S. Air Force has finally been changed from undesirable to honorable. She was caught up in what came to be known in the mid-1950s as the Lavender Scare and agreed to the discharge following hours of interrogation about her suspected lesbianism after authorities threatened to inform her parents. Failing to get an honorable discharge meant that she didn't qualify for the GI Bill and other veterans' benefits, and that she couldn't be buried in a national cemetery or with a color guard. James officially applied to have her discharge changed to honorable with the Air Force Board for Correction of Military Records last year. The board said that her records were destroyed in a fire several decades ago, so a determination could not be reached. She then filed a federal lawsuit against the Air Force. Now 90-year-old Helen Grace James was notified via a FedEx-delivered letter this week that, without explanation, the board had decided to upgrade her discharge status to honorable. She told reporters that getting that letter was both a joy and a shock. She said that it was important to her to get the upgraded status to prove I am a good person and that I deserve to be a whole civilian in this country I love.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude, for the week ending January 20th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
The U.S. government shut down to celebrate day 365 of the Trump presidency. Oh, wait, that's wrong. The government shutdown was the result of the great dealmaker being unable to forge a budget deal among warring factions of his own Republican Party, although Trump blames the Democrats. That's a different tune than the one he sang with the host of Fox and Friends as an onlooker when the government shut down in September 2013 under President Obama.
You know, 25 years and 50 years and 100 years from now, when the government is, you know, when they talk about the government shutdown, they're going to be talking about the president of the United States. Who was the president at that time? Mm-hmm. They're not going to be talking who the head of the House was, the head of the Senate. They're going to be discussing one person. So I really think the pressure is on the president, personally, in terms of his own
legacy.
History.
Yeah.
While hundreds of thousands were preparing for the January 20th Women's March around the world to protest his policies, Trump congratulated himself on January 19th for becoming the first U.S. president to address the annual March for Life rally in Washington, D.C. to protest the 1973 Supreme Court decision establishing a woman's right to choose. However, Trump's appearance was via satellite from the White House Rose Garden and not at the event itself. He also signed a letter earlier in the week congratulating the queer political group Log Cabin Republicans on its 40th anniversary, one day after signing a presidential religious freedom proclamation that appears to support faith-based anti-LGBT bias.
I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens.
He's a showboat. He's a grandstander.
He lies. He cheats. He's a bully.
This is like Watergate, only it's worse.
He went to Jared.
Believe me. Believe me. Believe me. Believe me, folks.
Dumbass.
American carnage. It's a little bit sad.
Bye, 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 bye.
the wider queer community often misunderstands or dismisses bisexuality entirely, making me feel as though I have to repress part of my identity in order to be accepted by my own community.
Can out bis ever be in later in the program? But first, queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason, clearly a Yankee, goes down south for a lesson in love.
A very interesting read that I picked up recently is Aunt Sookie and Me, The Sordid Tale of a Scandalous Southern Belle by Michael Scott Garvin, 2017 Create Space. This book is a Southern coming-of-age story about a young girl on the cusp of adolescence who lives with her riotously funny aunt in Savannah, Georgia, in 1968. The main character has a secret, and because it makes the character and the plot more complex, I'll tell you what the secret is. Despite the fact that she declares that she is a girl, the narrator, Poppy, was born Samuel, and on moving to Savannah from another small southern town, decided not to tell anyone, for a time, about her carefully guarded secret. Aunt Sookie and Me is a novel about difference in the midst of sameness. The aunt is eccentric. The mother, who drops in now and then, has more than her share of problems. And the ice cream man is gay. On a grand level, this novel is about conformity and how this often doesn't work, especially for people who happen to be female. It also is a novel about acceptance, including, perhaps starting with, self-acceptance. Ultimately, this extremely well-written novel is about love. After reading it, I will never view any small southern town with the same eyes. Not only does this novel contain some important history, it proves that, yes, we do exist. And because of this, we make things more interesting. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Together, come on, baby, let's go. I don't have to make the choice. I like girls and I like boys. I don't have to make the choice. I like girls and I like boys.
The B may have its place in the standard acronym, but a young social critic from Outcasting thinks that living, breathing bisexuals have a hard time finding a place in the queer community.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Lucy, a youth participant in Outcasting's Bureau at Michigan State University. On this edition, Outcaster Samantha talks about not feeling queer enough for the LGBTQ community because of her bisexual identity.
I have never felt queer enough. As a bisexual woman, my sexuality is often disregarded as a phase, a stepping stone on the way to becoming a full-blown lesbian. For years, I thought that my feelings for men invalidated my feelings for women. I thought that I had to choose, gay or straight, and ignore any desires that went against my choice. But that's not how it works. I don't have a say in whom I am attracted to or whom I fall in love with. Choosing to focus on my attraction to one gender will not erase my feelings for another. But the wider queer community often misunderstands or dismisses bisexuality entirely, making me feel as though I have to repress part of my identity in order to be accepted by my own community. In the 1940s, Alfred Kinsey developed the Kinsey Scale, a 7-point sexuality rating that ranges from 0, exclusively heterosexual, to 6, exclusively homosexual. He helped to foster the popular notion still embraced by the queer community today that sexuality is a spectrum. However, many people, both within and outside of the LGBTQ community, use the Kinsey Scale as a sort of queer litmus test. Technically speaking, anyone who identifies between 1 and 5, indicating some attraction to more than one gender, could label themselves as bisexual. Yet the idea still persists that those who identify as perfect threes and experience equal attraction to men and women are the only true bisexuals, even though this is not a universal or common experience among bisexuals. This is why I do not feel queer enough. It's a feeling of being isolated and untethered, of being too queer for the straight world, but not queer enough for the LGBTQ community. In fact, I don't even feel bi enough if I can't label myself as a 3 on the Kinsey scale. So where does this leave bisexual people? If we are always forced to quantify our queerness, will we ever feel like we belong to a community? The B in LGBTQ signifies that bisexual people are part of the queer community, but asking us to pick and choose parts of our identity, to constantly prove that we're queer, that we exist, can make us feel like outsiders. I have often felt embarrassed sitting in classes, surrounded by my openly queer peers who have been out since middle school, while I, a grown woman, am still partially closeted, despite knowing how important it is to be out and visible, especially for bisexual people. In fact, according to a 2013 survey conducted by the Pew Research Center, bisexuals are much less likely than gay men or lesbians to have come out to the important people in their life. While 77% of gay men and 71% of lesbians are out to all or most of the important people in their life, only 28% of bisexuals are. There are many reasons people may choose to remain closeted, but the stigma surrounding bisexuality makes it particularly difficult to come out, especially when support from the queer community is tenuous. Many gay and lesbian people feel as though bisexuality invalidates homosexuality because it makes sexuality look like a choice. When bisexual people are conceptualized as 50% straight and 50% queer, it invalidates our position within the LGBTQ community. People say that we need to pick a side, that we shouldn't be in queer spaces if we're not in a same-sex relationship, that we should be grateful to have straight-passing privilege when in fact neither the straight nor the queer community is seeing us as whole people. Being erased is not a privilege. It doesn't feel good to pretend you fit in with the straight world, knowing people don't see you in your entirety, but it's even worse to think that if you're honest, the queer community may not have your back either. The wider queer community also participates in perpetuating stereotypes about bisexuals, claiming they are promiscuous or incapable of monogamy. This leads to problematic popular representations of bisexuality. For example, Transparent, an Amazon Prime television show marketed toward the LGBTQ community, portrayed its only self-identified bisexual character as a polyamorous sex addict whose only plot function is to complicate a heterosexual couple's relationship by having threesomes with them. Also, celebrities who act as de facto spokespeople for the LGBTQ community perpetuate negative images of bisexuality. One of these celebrities is Cynthia Nixon, who played Miranda Hobbs on Sex and the City. She openly denies her bisexuality because she doesn't like the term and is currently in a same-sex relationship, even though she still claims to be attracted to both men and women. Defining your sexuality is a personal matter, of course, but when the term bisexual is rooted in stigma, people are hesitant to proudly claim it. The LGBTQ community tends to view bisexual people through a monosexual lens, conceptualizing us as straight when we're with people of the opposite sex and queer when we're with people of the same sex. This misunderstanding of bisexuality makes me worry that if I marry a man one day, I will lose the support of the queer community entirely because they would only see a heterosexual relationship, not my queer identity. Regardless of whom I end up with long term, I will always be bisexual. Yet the queer community often puts pressure on bisexuals to prove their sexuality, wanting us to recount our personal sexual history, how many men we've been with, and how many women, before they believe that we're bisexual. Not only is this practice invasive, but it reduces bisexual people down to a number yet again. I desperately want to be a part of the LGBTQ community because I feel the most like myself when I'm around other queer people. I don't want to be isolated any longer, drifting somewhere in the middle of the Kinsey scale, but never landing in a full-fledged community. I want to belong so much that I've even had a hard time writing this piece because I'm worried that I'll never be fully accepted in the queer community if I critique it for often excluding bisexual people. I'm still learning to accept myself and see my sexuality as valid and worthy of being a part of the wider queer community, but it's up to the LGBTQ community to create an environment that is supportive of bisexual people and conducive to their coming out. I cannot speak for all bisexuals, but from my perspective, being a part of the LGBTQ community allows us to be ourselves in a way we can't be elsewhere. It allows us to embrace our identities instead of running away from them. Most importantly, it allows us to feel a little less alone. But I won't subject myself to queer litmus tests and never-ending skepticism of my identity in order to be included in a community that markets itself as welcoming while putting conditions on my sexuality. I do not have to quantify my queerness for anybody, including myself. I am bisexual, and that is enough.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to Outcasting and Outcasting Overtime. Our Michigan State University faculty advisors are Mark Waddell and Jerry Alumet Zaldez, and our executive producer is Mark Sofis. Special thanks to WKAR Radio at Michigan State University for help in making this recording. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
They might have fallen out of the headlines recently, but gay and bisexual men in Chechnya still live in fear of being detained and tortured. Living Without Prejudice is a charity set up to bring awareness to the ongoing purge in the southern Russian Republic. Late last year, LWP gathered a coterie of queer musicians and allies to record a cover of the 90s hit Stronger Together to benefit the cause.
We're stronger together, we're stronger together, gonna be together forever now, baby. Oh.
Profits from the single Stronger Together will go to aid gay and bisexual men being persecuted in Chechnya. For more information, Google Energize Records. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Christopher Gall and Michelle Yater, produced by Steve Pride, from Janet Mason, and from Outcasting Overtime's Lucy and Samantha, produced by Mark Sophos. Peaches performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WCBN Ann Arbor, Michigan, KALW San Francisco, California, 2RRR Gladesville, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What do food and agriculture have to do with political economy? What do food systems and agricultural arrangements and land fertility and the treatment of people who work the land, what do these things have to do with economic regimes and political ideologies and the development and dynamics of capitalism? In the eyes of Eric Holt Jimenez, our current corporate food regime must be replaced with an equitable and resilient system. And that, he says, requires changing everything. And that requires an understanding of the structures of neoliberal capitalism that dictate what we grow, what we eat, and what's happening to rural land and rural populations. Eric Holt Jimenez directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First. And for more than two decades, he worked with peasant movements in Mexico and Central America. He's authored and edited a number of books, and his new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. When Eric Holt Jimenez joined me recently in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I asked him what he was hoping to do with this book.
What I wanted to do with this book is really start with some political economic literacy for the food movement. I think that the food movement writ large has gotten to a place where it's starting to have a political impact and can begin thinking about political strategy. In the United States especially, I think we're really crippled by a lack of concepts and terminology that allows us to engage forcefully politically. And so this book is about political economy, and it's, you know, using the C word out loud because we have to. We desperately need to. We need to realize this is a capitalist food system. It's going to act the way capitalism acts. And if we want to change a capitalist food system, then we better understand capitalism. So that's what the book is for.
In chapter one, you describe the three global food regimes that have emerged historically. And it begins, this first chapter, with the role of agriculture in capitalist development and with the so-called enclosures that occurred in the British Isles. When and how did enclosures happen?
So if you go back to the 16th century, we begin to see the emergence of industry. And industry needs raw materials. In this case, the industry needed wool for the spinning looms in the cities that were being built. And they had a lot of difficulty getting enough supply because the peasantry was growing food. And yeah, they had some sheep out there, but they basically, you know, carded and spun their own stuff and sold a little bit on the market. Well, not enough for this industrial leap. So what happened was that the large landed gentry saw an opportunity. They basically shoved the peasantry off the land in order to put sheep on it. And the way they did that was first to enclose the commons. That's what we call them, the enclosures. And by enclosing the commons, privatizing the commons, something which goes on still today, peasants no longer had access to fuel and fodder and medicinal plants and couldn't graze their animals on the commons anymore. So, and this was an important part of peasant economy and village life. So they then had to work for wages. The other thing that happened was they got taxed. And so having to come up with money and not being able to rely on their full economy, they were forced to go to the cities to work. And they were also forced to then work on the larger, what became at that time something close to plantations.
So there was a kind of consolidation of land ownership at the time?
Tremendous consolidation of land ownership. And this really characterizes capitalism. This is what Marx calls primitive accumulation, or original accumulation, some people call it. But it's that where you basically, the bourgeoisie, or the industrial class, or whomever it happens to be, could be a mercantile class as well, steals, appropriates, expropriates, and dispossesses people and villages and communities of their wealth. And in this case, the wealth was in the land, and so that's what they took, and that's what they needed. And so tremendous consolidation took place, which then creates this huge reserve army of labor. What's important to understand is that people resisted. They resisted for centuries. And so this was not a quick process, and it wasn't seamless by any means. It was actually very violent and bloody, and many people died, starved, and withered, certainly, in what were called the satanic mills in the industrial areas of jolly old England.
In the mid-19th century, British tariffs on imported grain were removed, opening the British Isles to imported grain. Was this the end of, or was this end of, British self-sufficiency in food production? Was this seen by elites as a problem?
Well, it depends on which elites. So if we're talking about the landed gentry, yes, this is a problem, because suddenly the grains and the wool and, you know, the things which they are producing for the market with the help of peasant labor are being undercut by, you know, grain from the Ukraine, for example. And so they're very much against this. But the British industrialists are very much in favor, because this cheapens the food basket. And they can then pay the workers relatively less, because food is less expensive. So, you know, there was a struggle, an interclass struggle between the gentry and the bourgeoisie, and the bourgeoisie won.
And the bourgeoisie won, and one thing that certainly helped the situation of food in the British Isles was the fact that Britain was going elsewhere for raw materials and fertile lands and crops, right?
Absolutely. You know, dual processes were going on. On one hand, British high farming was being developed. And high farming was simply a form of farming for the gentry, which relied on peasant labor, but also relied very much on guano, which is nitrate-rich bird droppings, which they had to import. So this was like the first green revolution, really. Rather than using chemical fertilizers, they were using guano. So on one hand, Britain is specializing in its agricultural sector on the island, and not necessarily to feed Britain, but also for export. On the other hand, the British Empire is expanding and conquering and exploiting and extracting all around the world. And so we have what's called the dawn of the first colonial food regime, which is, you think about a food regime as all of the institutions and all of the rules which govern food production and consumption. Now, it doesn't have to be complete. In other words, not everybody in the world has to do this the same way, but it does have to be hegemonic. And certainly the British Empire's food regime was hegemonic, as were some of the other colonial powers. And so what we get then is that the industrial North is able to industrialize in part because they've dispossessed and exploited the peasantry on their own soil, but also because they dispossess and exploit the peasantry in foreign countries, which become their colonies. So the global South, or what becomes the third world, the colonies of Africa, Asia, and certainly Latin America, ship cheap raw materials and food to the North. And this is a huge subsidy to the North, allowing it to industrialize. And that's really what characterizes the global food regime. It was the time of the most overt acts of genocide and expansion, and the bloodiest forms of primitive accumulation.
Yeah, and you write about how crops like maize and potatoes and rice and sugar and tea, how important they were to early European capitalism. Rice, by the way, from Africa, plays an important role in cultivation in the, quote, New World. And slavery was, of course, a big part of that. You write that prior to slavery, capitalist agriculture failed to keep up with the growing demand for cotton because capitalists could not force the peasantry to grow it on an industrial scale. How did slavery change that picture?
Yeah, this is a common challenge for capitalism, is to get enough raw materials and to extract enough of this material wealth from the countryside when the countryside is held either by peasants or indigenous people. And they just can't get them to produce enough. And so then they have to conquer. You know, all of the cultivars which you mentioned became commodities, traded on global markets. And they all have a very sordid story behind them. Rice is especially heartbreaking because rice was grown by Africans who were experts at tidal irrigation, and they were also very good at milling the rice, which is a hard thing to do manually. And the Africans who were enslaved and put to work in the colonies had this knowledge. So rice, the knowledge of how to cultivate rice comes over with Africans. And they did. And in the beginning, those who knew how to grow rice had to teach their masters how to do it. And they did this on the basis of exchange. There's evidence to, very strong evidence to suggest that early African farmers who had been enslaved negotiated for plots of land, negotiated for better treatment in exchange for growing rice. Unfortunately, when the masters learned how to grow the rice, that was all reversed. So that's a sort of a tragic story of what is, you know, an endogenous crop actually from Africa. We think all rice comes from Asia. It doesn't. This rice almost certainly all came from Africa.
Eric Holt Jimenez joins me. He is the director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First, and his new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. It's published by Monthly Review Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Yeah, and just to read something from your book that kind of summarizes what you've been talking about, quote, "When we look at the emergence of the capitalist food system, we see that regulation in the form of the enclosures that privatize the production and flow of goods and the violent dispossession of land and resources by state-financed armies and the exploitation of labor by coercive means such as poverty and slavery allow the system to emerge." So we've been talking about the first food regime, the colonial food regime, and you write that in the early 20th century, the first regime was replaced with a second global food regime. What happened during World War I and after to kind of shake things up?
Yeah, wars, particularly global wars, have a habit of really shaking up food regimes. So, you know, what happened is in the United States, after colonization and after independence and after the Civil War and the 13th Amendment and the liberation of enslaved people in the United States, is that steadily we begin to increase our productive capacity. And of course, the dispossession of indigenous lands and the slaughter of indigenous people continues apace as we spread across the continent. And this provides a tremendous sort of natural capital subsidy to the United States. Slavery has already provided tremendous, tremendous wealth to the financial system in the United States, and the government is able to borrow that in order to finance armies. Who are in the armies? Mostly dispossessed peasants from Europe. Anyways, we get this tremendous expansion and steady rise in productivity up to the point of the early 1900s. And in the early 1900s, when, you know, close to 80% of our population was rural, farmers were actually politically very powerful. It was called at that time the Golden Age of Agriculture because farmers got prices which were commensurate with, you know, a good living wage. And it was called parity. And farmers basically had parity. Then comes the First World War, which was fought amongst the European colonial powers. The United States pretty much stayed out of it for the early period. And Europe buys steel from the United States, buys a lot of food from the United States. And so farming starts to boom. Farmers are actually getting rich. And then they take that money and they're put it in the bank, and then the banks are flush with money from both Europe and the rural sector itself. Well, that's called a crisis of accumulation. The bank has to reinvest that money because they have to pay interest on that money. So they invested in agriculture. And so the price of land begins to skyrocket because it's so valuable, because you can make so much money and you can borrow so much on it. So farmers took out, you know, one, two, three, four mortgages on their land and bought more land and produced more. And everybody was really getting rich until the armistice was signed, and then the party was over, because very soon after that, Europe began to produce food again and prices crashed. And it's not just that prices crashed for food, but for all of the other products which we had been selling Europe, and all the other products which we had been making for our own armed forces, which really got our economy moving. And that's when we get the 1929 crash.
Which must have added insult to injury at that point for farmers.
Yeah, well, they were the first crash. They were the crash before the crash, because their prices evaporated. And they desperately, this is the problem with farming, is that you have high fixed costs. And so if you go into debt one year because prices go down, the next year you don't cut back on production. You've got to pay that debt. And so farmers try to farm their way out of debt by planting more. But if everybody's got a debt and everybody's planting more because prices are low, all that does is crash the market. So farmers tried to establish forms of, you know, cartels for, you know, milk or wheat or beef or whatever, and they just couldn't do it. They're too far flung. They aren't organized enough. And in and of themselves, they weren't able to avoid the crash of agriculture, which preceded the 1929 crash. So it all came to a very inglorious end.
And then after the Great Depression, of course, we saw the New Deal in the U.S. You associate the dawn of the second global food regime with the New Deal.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, the government steps in to do what people can't do on their own, and what farmers as business people can't do on their own, and as producers can't do on their own. So the government steps in and institutes the New Deal. Well, the first part of the New Deal started with the food system. And the first was to ensure close to parity prices for farmers. So guaranteed price, build up grain reserves to maintain prices stable. If the prices go down too low, you buy up grain and put it in reserve, and it raises prices. If prices are up too high, you release some grain on the market. It lowers prices, keep that stable. Farmers like that. And then they limited production. There were essentially quotas. You could only produce so much, and you were paid not to produce so that you wouldn't crash the market, so that the 1929-28 crash wouldn't repeat itself. And then with the surplus, which is being stored, the government gave away the food to poor people. Now, this didn't completely solve the problem, and we hear about the bread lines knee-deep in wheat as the United States was trying to pull itself out of the recession. But this introduces a new, completely new stage of state involvement in agriculture. And it's very clear that agriculture is critical to the general economic recovery of the nation. And again, we begin to enter into this area of increased productivity and agricultural expansion right on through to the Second World War. And this is the second food regime, which ends up producing so much food that after the Second World War, sort of the history repeats itself. The U.S. gets in late to the into the action and makes a lot of money before the war selling to Europe. But then after the war, Europe is destroyed, but the productive capacity in the United States has not been touched at all. In fact, it's increased, both in terms of agriculture and everything else. So we turn swords into plowshares. Turn the nitrates into fertilizers. We turn the poison gas into pesticides, and we turn the tanks into tractors. And we begin to produce tremendous amounts of food. We include these in the Marshall Plan, and we feed Europe. Of course, Europe is borrowing all this money. But the next stage, then, we loan money to Europe so they can buy our equipment. So Europe modernizes its agricultural sector. and begins to overproduce food, right, when the U.S. is overproducing food. So what are we going to do with all this food? And the answer was development. We decided to save the world from hunger, and we began to ship food overseas as food aid, which was then sold, actually, in countries, poor countries, at prices which were below the cost of production in those countries, which put their local farmers out of business. And what we have then is a reversal. If the colonial food regime, the flow of food went from south to north, now the flow of food is going from north to south. In order for that to happen, they had to destroy the food systems, the markets and food systems in the south in order to absorb the tremendous surplus which was being produced in the north.
Eric Holt Jimenez is his name. He directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy. He's the author of Campesino a Campesino, Voices from Latin America's Farmer-to-Farmer Movement for Sustainable Agriculture, and co-author of Food Rebellions, Crisis and the Hunger for Justice. We are talking about his new book. It's called A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. We'll take a short music break and speak more with Eric about his very interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Holt Jimenez is my guest. For more than two decades, he worked with peasant movements in Mexico and Central America. He's the author and co-author and editor of many books about food movements and land justice and food rebellions. And he directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First. It's an Oakland-based organization that works to end the injustices that cause hunger. His new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. There's so much in just this first chapter, Eric, that we're going to skip around a little bit. But the Green Revolution, which lasted from 1960 to 1990, it was a campaign to spread capitalist agriculture to the countries of the global south. So how much of this has to do with exporting farming-related inputs like fertilizers and pesticides and farm equipment to poorer countries, poorer nations?
Well, that has everything to do with that, and much less to do with ending hunger, as it was sold as the way to end hunger. And what we've seen with the Green Revolution, regardless of the Nobel Prizes that have been given away to some of the authors of the Green Revolution, for ending hunger, saving a billion people from hunger, what we see, and this is sort of Food First's trademark, is that the Green Revolution produced as many or more hungry people than it saved. And, you know, the story has been very well documented. Ford and Rockefeller got together, so think about oil and machinery, and realized that neither Europe nor the U.S. could absorb any more of these products. Farmers had bought everything they possibly could. It's almost like food, you know. Once you're satiated, you can't really eat anymore. Mm. And they couldn't buy any more pesticides or fertilizers or new seeds or new tractors. It just wasn't feasible. So they decided to export, find a way to export these goods. And the first thing they did was they hired a man named Carl Sauer, who was a anthropologist here at the University of California, Berkeley, very renowned anthropologist who knew Mexico, certainly, backwards and forwards. They told Carl to go down and do a study on hunger in Mexico and how U.S. technology could solve the problem of hunger by raising yields. He did go down, and when he came back, he basically said they're doing fine. They have some infrastructure problems, and they have some difficulties in moving food from one place to another, but actually they have a very resilient food system. They have hundreds of different varieties of maize and beans and cultivars to feed themselves. They have an extensive ejido system in which farmers gain access to land and have land security in order to produce these crops. They have, on and on and on. They've kind of had a New Deal plus going on in Mexico as a result of the Mexican Revolution. And he said, basically, stay away. You guys could probably do more damage than good. So they didn't like that answer, and they hired someone who would give them the answer they wanted, and that man was Norman Borlaug. He was a crop scientist from the Midwest. He went down and said, oh, we can fix this. And that's where he began developing dwarf wheats and whatnot that responded well to high applications of fertilizer and irrigation and to machinery. So the Green Revolution, in the first instance, is implemented on the best land in Mexico and the best land in India, also in the Punjab, and has spectacular results. You know, they raise productivity, and then banks loan money from the U.S. to governments in the global south so that they can buy these new products. So it very quickly began to displace peasant agriculture again, very much like the high farming did back during the time of the enclosures. And the peasantry isn't able to afford these things, and so is steadily displaced, and larger plantations are established and consolidated. And then when the large landowners could no longer absorb all of these products, the Green Revolution shifted gears.
Right. They shifted gears, if I understand the book correctly, toward allowing peasant farmers to buy these inputs by lending them money.
Precisely. And this is really a big deal because, you know, before, to borrow money, you needed to have collateral. And most peasants didn't have collateral. Many of them didn't own the land that they were on, or this was ejido land, which you can't use for collateral. This was all changed. And they just loaned the money directly to peasants and counted on the harvest for paying back. But this completely transforms peasant agriculture. For one thing, peasant agriculture was very agricultural. They had a lot of different cultivars growing at the same time in one place, very complicated crop associations that built resilience into the system. Well, with the Green Revolution, you buy one seed and you grow it on the entire plot. So even things as simple as the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, was effectively prohibited. If you took out a loan and bought these seeds, you were not allowed to grow corn, beans, and squash. You could only grow the corn. So farmers did this. You know, they had already been displaced from the best lands to the poorest lands. So with this second iteration of the Green Revolution, and poor farmers are provided with the inputs, remember that we've almost doubled the amount of land under cultivation. So we have tremendous, tremendous flush of food on the market. And whenever that happens, the markets crash. And that's exactly what happened. The markets begin to crash. Peasants go out of business. Then, of course, the land consolidates again.
Yeah, and although you, as you indicated, initially yields were increased, yields from these fields and farms were increased, and there was a glut of basic grains as a consequence, there were impacts on the land, right, from synthetic fertilizer application and pesticide application and the planting of these hybrid seeds. What happened to the land?
Yeah, well, what happens is that because peasants are marginalized onto fragile lands, and this can be hillsides, forest frontiers, on the edges of deserts or arid areas, very quickly fertilizers burn up the organic matter in the soil, particularly in the tropics where the solar radiation is so much stronger that the metabolic processes are accelerated So you lose your natural fertility very quickly. So then you have to add more fertilizer. And the more you add, sort of the worse it gets until you have essentially a mineral soil. That's exactly what happened to the peasantry. On the other hand, then, the minute you institute monocultural agriculture, when you grow only one crop, what you're doing is creating sort of a petri dish for pests. And they multiply rapidly, and then you've got to add more pesticides, and that just kills all of the beneficial insects and the predator insects, and so you get more pests. And it's called the agricultural treadmill or the chemical treadmill. And it's one thing to be on that treadmill if you're a big farmer, because you usually get bailed out with subsidies or forgiveness. But when you're a peasant farmer, no one bails you out. And so peasants were going broke, both because of the structure of the market, but also because of the ecological impact of the inputs they were being sold.
So the Green Revolution, you write, lasted until 1990. You also write about a third food regime, today's corporate food regime, which was built on the two food regimes that preceded it. So what's the relationship between the Green Revolution and the corporate food regime? And what do we need to know about the corporate food regime, the regime that exists and is hegemonic today?
What happens is that remember that the Green Revolution was a government-sponsored campaign. So these are public monies which go in to develop a far-flung network of international research centers for agricultural research. It's called CGIAR. So tremendous amounts of public money is plowed into the Green Revolution, really for the benefit primarily of large seed companies and fertilizer companies and farm machinery companies. But this exhausts itself. First, it exhausts itself ecologically because it's destroying the soil and destroying the agroecosystems and surrounding environments. And so the returns to the Green Revolution are fewer and fewer, and there's less and less interest on the part of government to fund this campaign. But then it also exhausts itself because basically the New Deal capitalism exhausts itself. And we enter into a period of neoliberalization starting in the late 80s, or starting in the 80s, with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan beginning to roll back all of the social aspects of our governments and privatize everything. Well, this happened even more intensely in the global south, which has to do with the debt crisis, both in farming and of the global south in general. But the way to privatize then shifts not just the agriculture, but shifts entire societies. Because what happens is that the global south was loaned money from private banks in the north to develop their forces of production. This very much included agriculture. But then when capitalism enters into a phase of overproduction and these products lose their value, the banks in the north decide they're going to call in their loans. And that's where we get the third world debt crisis, because countries can't afford to pay. That's also where we lose half of the farmers in the United States, because farmers go broke because they can't afford to pay, because their products are not worth anything either. So we get tremendous consolidation in the north. But in the south, how are you going to foreclose on Mexico? So that's when the structural adjustment policies were invented. So the World Bank would come in and say, you're behind on your payments. We'll loan you more money for your payments, but you have to sign a contract with this guy over here. And he was always a guy. And that was the International Monetary Fund. And the International Monetary Fund imposed structural adjustments. And these, for agriculture, were devastating. Because the first thing they said was, you must dismantle all of your grain reserves. You have to reevaluate your currency. You must put up all of your government agencies and programs for sale. And of course, agriculture during the Green Revolution depended on all of these agencies in order to extend its products. So we move into the next food regime in which agricultural ministries, for example, are almost completely privatized, which means that the peasantry is abandoned because larger farmers can afford to pay experts and extensionists, and the peasantry cannot. Food becomes very complicated. It's not just flowing north to south. It's flowing north to south, south to north, east to west. You have the vast, far-flung complexes like the grain oilseed livestock complex, where grains are grown, you know, in the Argentine pampas, and then they're turned into feed somewhere in the Midwest. And then we plow that into, you know, the hog and chicken farms and the big CAFOs, confined animal feedlot operations. And then we export that meat all over the world. So it gets very, very complicated, becomes completely corporatized. And we come into what we call either the corporate food regime or the neoliberal food regime, which is what we have today.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Holt Jimenez is my guest in studio. He is the executive director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, or Food First. His new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. So there's much more in this book, an extraordinary amount of information offered in this book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. But I want to turn to what you think as what you see as possible changes within the food system, changes to the corporate food regime, who might do this, how it might be done, what specifically needs to be done. So there is a food movement out there, a very active food movement on many different levels. What do you think, kind of in general terms, about where the food movement, what kind of change the food movement might be able to effect?
Well, the first thing we have to realize is that the corporate food regime is a capitalist food regime. And so it's going to act the way capitalism acts. And we know some things about capitalism. We've been studying it for over 300 years. And Karl Polanyi documented how capitalism goes through different phases, different periods. It bounces back and forth between periods of liberalism and periods of reform. And when he says liberalism, he means market liberalization.
Gotcha.
You know, taking the gloves off the market, no regulation. And you come into a period of tremendous concentration of wealth, but also into a period in which society is completely exposed to the market. People are unprotected by their governments from the volatility and the violence of the market. And so historically, what people have done is they rise up and they fight back. They make things so uncomfortable that, in fact, they forced reformists to institute reforms. This usually happens after a big crash when people are miserable. So we thought that this might have happened when we had the stock market crash here, in the financial crash in 2008, 2009, but nothing changed. In effect, the banks got bailed out, and that was it. There were no reforms. And what was the difference? The difference was that there was not a strong counter movement. There was a social movement so strong that they could create political will to institute reforms, make the politicians do the right thing. Otherwise, they just do the thing that capital demands. And I think that when you look around the world, you see counter movements growing. And the food movement is, I believe, one of the prominent counter-movements to capitalism, and it's a counter-movement to the corporate food regime. And neither the corporate food regime nor the food movement is monolithic. There's a lot of diversity in both, but there are some trends, some very identifiable trends. So if the corporate food regime has a neoliberal wing, which is now quite hegemonic, they also have a reformist wing, which is now quite weak. Food movements have a very progressive wing that is really grappling with the day-to-day difficulties of the food system. So that's where we see, you know, organic farmers, community agriculture, food policy councils, farm-to-school programs, all this plethora of, you know, fascinating responses to the injustices and the inadequacy of the corporate food regime, of our food systems. These are very practical folks.
Would you call them reformist? Are they pushing for reforms to the food system?
You know, primarily, I think the progressives are the doers. They're not terribly political, although we're beginning to see differences there. And as such, they're very easily co-opted by reformists from within the corporate food regime. I mean, there's quite a bit of money there, for one thing, and most community organizations don't have money. And so, you know, most of the sort of reformist foundations and reformist wings of government, you know, attempt to establish alliances with progressives because the reformists are weak.
And what do the reformists within the corporate food regime, what do they want?
Well, they basically want the same thing as the neoliberals, except they want safety nets. So, you know, EBT, you know, food stamps would be a safety net which reformists would defend, whereas neoliberals want to do away with it. Both believe in the food enterprise system, and they both believe in sort of the formula of overproduction and for getting things done. And they both believe in the power of corporations to solve the world's problems without really seeing how corporations themselves are the problem.
So what do you think of the tendency of the progressive trend within the food movement, or a significant part of it, to ally themselves with reformists?
Well, I think that it's a big mistake, because basically you're going to be reinforcing the corporate food regime. That's where they come from. I think that progressives are actually very pivotal. If they throw their weight and their alliances towards reformists, I believe the corporate food regime is strengthened. But if they throw their weight to who I'm calling the radicals, it's a different story. Because you think about the more radical trends within the food movement, these are the folks who want to change the rules and the institutions. They want agriculture out of the World Trade Organization. They want land reform. They want to dismantle the power of monopolies and corporate power. So they're really looking at the structures of capitalism, whereas the progressives are looking at the practices of farming. If these two are able to form strategic alliances, and I think we already see this happening, then the food movement is strengthened as a counter movement. And we know historically that the only way reforms will ever be introduced are through strong, powerful counter movements. And certainly if we're thinking about not just reforming the system to stabilize it, but transforming the system, then we really need to build these strong strategic alliances between the progressive and radical sectors of the food movement.
Within these sectors, there are a lot of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, CBOs, community-based organizations. What is it about the funding of these groups that might encourage or discourage a turn toward a radical agenda, a turn toward an agenda that includes changing things on a fundamental level?
Well, in a word, the foundations. I mean, the funding. The left has been fragmented, both because of its own errors, but also because of the money that it's received from foundations. The foundations, the whole structure of foundations and charities is to, you know, fund specific organizations, fund their SMART objectives and their, you know, sort of quantifiable results, and not to fund, you know, a more transformative movement building activities. And so what this does is it pits community organizations against each other. We're all competing for funding when we should be working together. But we have no choice because we have no money, and the only place to get the money is from the foundations. And certainly there are a number of family foundations, I think, that recognize this and do try to support movement-building activities and alliances. But in general, what we have seen for decades now is the fragmentation of the left.
Eric Holt Jimenez joins us to talk about his new book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You believe that the food movement can only succeed, the counter movement can only succeed, if it builds a critical public sphere. What do you mean by that?
We often don't think about the public sphere anymore, and that's because it's been destroyed. Neoliberalism over the past 30 years has not just privatized our public services, it's destroyed the community relationships that we have or that we had. This is the public sphere, that part of our society where we come together, we debate, we analyze problems, and we make decisions based on what we collectively believe to be right or to be best. We don't just let the market decide. Because if the market decides, that means that whoever has the most market power is going to be making the decisions. And we know who that is. Those are the corporations. So it's no mistake that the public sphere has been decimated over the last 30 years. I talk to my students sometimes, and they don't know what a public sphere is. They're astounded to know that I went all the way through college and got my master's and my PhD without any debt whatsoever, through public scholarships, that there was public housing. And so part of our fragmentation under this supposed, entrepreneurial society that we have is our powerlessness and the illusion that we have powers as individuals when, in fact, we don't. We're completely being manipulated. And so reconstructing the public sphere, I think, is the first step towards building the social and political power that we need in order to change the food system. And I'll just give you a small example of where this is happening. The food policy councils. We have one here in Berkeley. We have one in Oakland and Richmond. And there are hundreds of them across the United States and Canada and in Australia, and they're popping up in Europe. So in the United States, it's really hard to change the laws and institutions around our food regime. You've got the Farm Bill. It's insulated by layer after layer of committee. They're not going to let any citizen touch that thing. That's for the politicians and the corporations to decide. But it sets the rules, and it sets the price of grain worldwide. Well, we can't change that today. We try and we try and we try, and there are basically no changes there. But we can change the food system at the local level. And so food policy councils are doing exactly that, bringing citizens together from all walks of life, small businesses, churches, the health sector, public health, et cetera. They come together, analyze problems, and begin to advance policies, rules, and institutions that help to humanize our food systems. And I'm very proud of the food policy councils here in the Bay Area. They've really done tremendous work trying to make land available for cultivation for urban dwellers, finding ways so that urban farmers can sell their products, finding ways so that immigrants can start food enterprises, and really beginning to see, can we localize our food system and democratize it as much as possible? That's public sphere in action.
How crisis-ridden is neoliberal capitalism today, and how important is it that the food movement and other movements mobilize particularly now to take advantage of the situation?
We see plenty of crises, food crises, even though we produce 1.5 times more than enough food for everybody. We've got close to 2 billion people going hungry. And we have, 1 in 7 going hungry in this country, richest country in the world. That doesn't seem to affect Wall Street at all. And of course, we've got the global warming, and agriculture and the food system contribute anywhere from 20 to 40% of the greenhouse gases, either whether it's nitrous or whether it's carbon. So the crises are certainly here. And, in the past, when we were able to institute reforms, there was a crash, crises, a crash, and there was a threat. And the threat before was communism. And so Roosevelt institutes reforms in order to keep the United States from going communist. Well, this time, I think the threat is global warming. And you can't establish detente with global warming. So we may be at the end of the line here. This might be the time where the concerns around food and the concerns around climate may well converge, and the crises around food and climate may well converge in such a way that we can get some real political traction and social traction to force changes upon the system.
Can what you call a good, clean, and fair food system, can that be constructed within capitalism?
Well, I think we have to look at the history. And, what people who say that are basically proposing is that we fix the food system. And if you want to fix the food system, you have to ask, well, that means it's broken, but when did it actually work well? It certainly didn't work well when we dispossessed indigenous peoples of their land and engaged in mass genocide. That didn't work too well for indigenous people. It didn't work well for enslaved Africans. Certainly has not worked well for immigrant farm workers. So I don't think we can fix this broken food system. It's not broken. It's a capitalist food system. It's working exactly as a capitalist food system is supposed to work. It concentrates wealth and it offloads all of the externalities to the public, the vulnerable public. And that's what it's doing today. So, no, I think the question to be asked is, it means we have to change everything. If we want to change the food system, we have to change everything. I think that because of the historic relationship of capitalism and our food system, they have co-evolved. If you change the food system, you're going to be introducing forcibly changes into capitalism. And then I think we also have to act to change capitalism itself in order to be able to change the food system that we have. So it's very much a dialectical process. It sounds daunting and overwhelming, and it is. And we don't know if this is going to work. We don't know how things are going to turn out. But we would know how things turn out if we do nothing, which I think we're heading for destruction.
Eric Holt Jimenez, Executive Director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First. Again, it's an organization that works to end the injustices that cause hunger. And we've been discussing his new book. It's called A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. Congratulations, Eric, on this book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, C.S. A pleasure to be with you.
And you can find Food First on the web at foodfirst.org. That's foodfirst.org. And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.